It remains secret for 150 years because these people are under an oath not to talk about it. I understand that a member of the order may not remain in the room if it comes under discussion. Now, if I can elaborate on this a little bit, this poses a problem for Mr. Bush, because I write something called the Phoenix Letter, which is a monthly newsletter, and last November I began to open up. And a reader wrote to Mr. Bush and said, is what Mr. Sutton says, are you a member of this order? And the letter he got, the reader got back, was very interesting. It said, in effect, that the vice president was not a member of a sordid secret society. That was not the question. The question was, are you a member of a secret society? The answer came back, he is not a member of a sordid secret society. Inserted the word, you see. This was a reader who doesn't give up, so he went back again. And I understand that, as it stands, as we are now, that Mr. Bush is not willing either to admit he is a member of the order or to deny it, because they're under this oath not to discuss it.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday, the 23rd of December 2022, streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please not Google. And the links, if you want, are on our show page to other app stores, non-Google app stores, at thisweek.org.uk. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner once more, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, smearing the cheap COVID treatment as it did, and Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity, followed now by God knows how many more from the poison death jabs. But everything's supposedly moved on now. All everyone's supposed to think about is Ukraine. The sidestepping our cocaine-snorting hero Zelensky's Zio-Nazi policies and masochistic Russian sanctions from Rishi Sunak and the rest of them in the City of London. An unhappy bunch of losers waging war on the British people now, as well as waging war on Putin too. So, navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution of self-immolation, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And in part one, we're going to start by looking at this incredible decision today to put in charge of science at the World Health Organization a chappie called Sir Jeremy Farrar. Now, he's the former boss of the Wellcome Trust, which actually, funnily enough, their research headquarters was next door to my secondary school back in Beckenham in Kent, back in the 1970s mostly I was there. And also, have we got a new vaccine for cancer? Apparently this mRNA is such a brilliant technology, they're going to give you a vaccine for cancer. Watch out for that one, folks. Just make sure it's safe, shall we, before we use it. And strikes, what are they really all about? Also, the very sad death of Terry Hall this week, the singer with the Specials, the Fun Boy 3, the Colour Field, and so we'll be peppering today's show with a few Terry Hall songs, hopefully in chronological order if I can get my act together. And also this week, some very bad news. In fact, this has been going on for a couple of years apparently, but Ray Vahey from BitChute has come clean on what's been going on, being bullied by HSBC, being treated basically exactly the same as HSBC Bank have been treating the Palestine campaigners. So obviously HSBC is just part of some sort of Zionist plot. So BitChute is where everybody's been going pretty much since the close down of YouTube, and now HSBC Bank has been trying to close down other the biggest alternative to YouTube, which is BitChute. In part two, behind the NATO firewall, we'll have a little look at RT this week and Sputnik, see what they're saying, as well as some investigations, of course. Hilda Morel, as I promised last week, look into her with David Halpin, as well as her her nephew, who happened to work for British Naval Intelligence. A new book out, a couple of years ago by him, and some fascinating insight, actually, in the speech that he gave at the launch of the book. The book's called A Thorn in Their Side, The Hilda Morel Murder. But as Robert Greene says, and you'll hear him later on saying, he's saying it was actually just a simple political assassination. That's what really happened. Also, following on from last week's long clip from the interview with James Files, the JFK assassin, we hear this week from Zach Shelton. He's the FBI officer who tipped Joe West originally off, the private investigator off, to look into James Files' role and the Chicago Mafia's role in the JFK assassination. So let's have listen to what Zach Shelton has had to say about this much more recently. And a big theme this week is the three wise men, the Magi. We hear from the mainstream sort of views on this from the theological world. Who were they? Who were these three wise men that turned up? They talk about the three kings, but they weren't three kings. They were, the Magi. And were they Babylonian Kabbalists? Or were they from Persia, possibly? Who knows? But anyway, we hear all sorts of views on that tonight. And also from David Livingston, who's written quite a lot about this era in history. He thinks this is where it all began. That's what he told me. We'll hear from him later. And also, as a sort of alternative Christmas message, because I don't know what we're going to get served up this weekend by King Charles, but it certainly isn't going to be anything up to the standard of his mum. And so, as an attempt to sort of do an alternative version, we've got Archbishop Vicario, who is a Catholic bishop who's been very critical of the World Economic Forum and of the COVID jabs, and a manifesto from Brother Alexis Bugnolo. Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom, and then cancelled off Bristol Community FM. That's us, by the Bristol media. You'll be hearing more about that in a little while from Andrew Bridgen, the way the BBC was closed down during the COVID era. No discussion about vaccine harm allowed from the top of the BBC, but not cancelled here. Now, Martin, you're not in the studio this week, and just wanted to see how you're getting on over Christmas.
Well, I'm down here at my parents' place. My dad's went into the hospital this afternoon for an operation for cancer, and we're just waiting to see what happens with that.
Well, why don't we just start with a little prayer for your dad? Heavenly Father, let's just hope that Martin's dad's okay today in hospital having his op, and that he comes back right as rain in the next few days, in Jesus' name. Amen. Little prayer just for your dad, Martin. So anyway, getting stuck in, let's look at the medical profession. I mean, there are some figures I would consider really just simply profiteering off people's need and desire to stay healthy. Jeremy Farrar is one of them, from the Wellcome Trust. I mean, these trusts and foundations, they are not the same as people like Pfizer and Moderna. They seem to have kind of taken over the whole world of medical research, including at universities too, the Wellcome Trust. And now they're putting him in charge in the top job. He's not actually going to be the director of the World Health Organization, but they're chief scientific advisor. So any kind of health issues in the future, we're going to get him advising the whole world now.
Well, World Health Organization has become captured by the Western pharmaceutical industry. That's pretty clear. Don't forget, the World Health Organization originally conceived as part of the UN system, and it's supposedly a government-funded public health body. But, of course, it's not properly funded. Poor countries can't afford to put much money into it. And, the major funders, big funders, were Western countries, because they're the ones with the money. But even they are not willing to fund it. But, of course, these trusts, which are actually, arms of the big corporations which created the trusts, then say, oh, well, we'll fund it. But that then means they get control of the policy. And you could say, well, the World Health Organization is completely corrupted. But on the other hand, the UN is completely corrupted. That, countries like Russia, China, Brazil, Argentina, etc., they can't just walk away from the World Health Organization, although the US did under Trump and has gone back in under Biden. But it's part of the general contestation for power on our tiny little planet. And, you can't, even if you engage with it, you've then got to deal with the real power structure and who's really in charge.
That's right. I mean, Norman Dodd, we played a clip a few months ago. I've, you know, played it several times over the years in the United States, looked into all of this. He concluded that these big foundations were on a mission to completely control the scientific research, historical research in the world, economic research, these sorts of things, by installing their own heads and chairs in the various universities and funding them. So this is part of the slide away from public government funding of universities and the move towards people like the Wellcome Trust starting to fund chairs, whole departments, build entire departments at universities.
Well, that's right. It's private charity and therefore tax deductible, so they don't have to pay any taxes on the money they put into these trusts. And then the trusts, surprise, surprise, come up with solutions to the world's problems, which require buying lots of expensive pharmaceuticals from the core pharmaceutical companies, which generate the profits, which then go into the trusts, which then dominate the political conversation, which then decide what the solutions and what the problems are that have got to be addressed. So, you know, they want to, and that, you can see that clearly the main medical problems of the human population are quite straightforward. It's things like dirty water, which kills thousands and thousands of children every day. But of course, there's no money to be made in solving that problem. So that's not really a priority. The priority is vaccination against whatever, because that is very expensive. And they're the people who can provide the necessary technology. So that's the distortion. And it's fundamental. And it's obvious, really, if you think about it. We don't actually address the main medical problems because there's no money to be made from addressing them. So we address secondary issues, which may be dangerous in various ways, but the whole thing is skewed by the private profit motivation of the people behind it.
I mean, I'm sure if Jeremy Farrar was sitting here now, I'm sure he would never, ever deign to join us. But if he did, he would say, well, actually, we're a not-for-profit organisation.
Yes, but you can say you're a not-for-profit organisation, but that doesn't mean you're an accountable organisation. The thing about having public money running public things is that if they get it wrong, you can say, well, that's wrong, and we don't like what you've done. Whereas if you are a not-for-profit organisation on the side of the angels, then you're not accountable. You know, you can just decide what you think is good. And because you're not making any money out of it directly, therefore you can't be accused of anything. But this is stupid because, you know, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and all the rest of it, and all of these foundations in the US, Tarpley is really good on this. They are vehicles for the wealthy classes and billionaires and oligarchs to avoid paying taxes, because you put money into this non-governmental, non-profit organization, you don't have to pay tax on it.
Yeah.
But then these non-for-profit organizations lobby for solutions to problems which require the stuff that's being produced by the for-profit arm of these people. Yeah.
Well, of course, Jeremy Farrar famously was...
Yes, and the whole thing is distorted in that way.
I'm not sure if he was...
Setting aside questions about, you know, COVID vaccinations or whatever, the general medical, you know, world health policy is dominated by the problems of the more prosperous part of the population. You know, they don't care about child mortality in poor countries. It's not an issue for them because these people have got no influence.
Well, let me just add something, Martin, because let me just add something in there because, for example, Merck were the pharmaceutical big pharma company that had the patent for ivermectin, incredibly useful drug used for stalling lots and lots of viruses from taking over the body in animals and in humans, as well as extremely effective anti-parasitic drug. And Merck realized that actually the main people who would want this drug would be poor and therefore wouldn't be able to pay a lot of money. So they just thought, well, we may as well just relinquish our patent on this because we can't make any money at it.
Well, I didn't know that, but it wouldn't surprise me. You've got to also recognize that the Western pharmaceutical companies do not dominate what goes on inside China, Russia, Cuba, or many of the countries under sanctions like Iran and Venezuela. They struggle to deal with the health problems of their population, but their problems are not that they're being bombarded with inappropriate medical care from Western corporations. They're under embargo. So even at the height of the pandemic, the Iranians were not allowed to access Western medical technology because they've got to give up their nuclear weapons, which they don't have, and change their government so that the Israelis are happy. And all of these things are linked, and it's not just medical oppression that we're suffering. There's a global crisis of the whole system which has dominated the planet for the last 500 years.
So, very good article by Ian Birrell in The Eye this week. World Health Organization's appointment of Jeremy Farrar, F-A-R-R-A-R, as chief scientist is scandalous. The COVID origin debate is now murkier than ever. And, of course, anyone that remembers back as far will know that Sir Jeremy Farrar, director of the Wellcome Trust and the next chief scientist at the World Health Organization, he was intimately involved in steering people towards the conclusion COVID had an origin. This is when it was just still called SARS-CoV-2, had an origin in bats, rather, or maybe pangolins, rather than a human origin of some sort. So now he is there. He is. So I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to that article. It's behind the firewall. Everyone seems to have these nowadays, apart from maybe it's the Express and the Sun at iNews. But I've got a copy of it, and also it's been altered. The one that's online has been changed 2 days after it was published this week. And the article is World Health Organization's appointment of Jeremy Farrar as chief scientist is scandalous. I mean, it's what it's saying is effectively now they put the pharmaceutical lobby, Martin, in charge of global health policy. He's not really just an advisor. He's saying to the World Health Organization, this is what you've got to do, guys, and they'll do it.
Well, it's, as I said, it's the World Health Organization, like all of these international bodies, is a site of struggle between different forces.
Well, it's been taken over. It's not a struggle anymore.
It hasn't been completely taken over, because Russia and China are still members of the World Health Organization, and they're not part of what's going on. They're not. Kirillov, the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare troops, with Chinese support, went to the UN Security Council and said, we're really unhappy with all these hundreds of biolabs that the US has been funding all around our borders. Now, they are not part of the Western pharmaceutical industry scam. They're not. They're at war with the West. And okay, nobody in China or Russia has had an mRNA vaccine.
So just looking at the fallout from Farrar's decisions and Sage's decisions back in early 2020 has been Dr. Asim Malhotra, who's actually caused quite a lot of ructions. And we're going to be hearing now from two ructions that he's caused. One is the interview he did on the Tucker Carlson show, and then secondly we're going to be hearing from Andrew Bridgen MP, who did a speech based on his evidence at the House of Commons. And now for something completely unconnected, of course, Andrew Bridgen has been suspended from the House of Commons. Now that's how it works, folks. But anyway, so let's hear from Dr. Asim Malhotra first, whose father died of a heart attack after having the vaccine, on Tucker Carlson. He's talking here about the corruption of medicine by Big Pharma.
A cardiothoracic surgeon called Stephen Gundry in the States published an abstract in the journal Circulation, which is the premier cardiology journal of the world, one of the most premier journals. And he found, monitoring hundreds of his patients, that after two doses of the mRNA vaccine, Pfizer or Moderna, there were increased markers of inflammation linked to coronary artery disease, increasing the risk after just 10 weeks of someone's risk of, say, having a heart attack of 11% in 5 years, right, suddenly jumped to 25% within 2 months. Now, just to put that in perspective, Tucker, if I decided today I was going to smoke 40 cigarettes, I was going to completely stop exercising and just gorge on junk food, I couldn't increase my risk even close to that in that space of time. Absolutely. Right. So I was like, okay, one bit of data. Okay, is it replicated? Is it coincidence? Whatever. As a scientist, you need to look at other signals. Then I got contacted by a cardiologist in a very prestigious British institution. I won't name the institution to protect him. I know this person very well. He has very high integrity. I've worked with him for many, many years. And he said, Asim, there's something I've got to tell you, and I'm very upset about it. I said, what is it? He says, in this institution, the cardiology research had found by accident looking at coronary imaging, so imaging of the heart, they found in vaccinated versus unvaccinated huge markers of coronary inflammation, right? A signal from the mRNA vaccines. They then had a meeting and they sat around and they said, listen, the lead researcher said, we're not going to publish these findings because it may affect our funding from the pharmaceutical industry.
Oh, come on.
So this person was very upset. I then now had my dad's situation. I had this heart attack.
Said that out loud?
In the closed meeting, they said it, yeah, in the closed meeting of those researchers.
Did anyone stop and say, I'm sorry, that's immoral?
Well, I think people were quite upset, and a lot of them were juniors, right? Junior doctors and junior researchers, and of course, they don't want to call out their boss. You can understand the situation. It's not easy. It's like, of course, they should have done, absolutely.
Oh.
So then I went on I thought, okay, there's a signal here. I went on GB News. So this was October, November of 2021. And I just said, listen, we've got these signals. We know there's an increase in heart attacks. And there's more than enough evidence to call for an investigation into this. And that's all I said. That interview went viral. In the meantime, behind the scenes, a couple of medical establishment bodies contacted me because of a number of anonymous complaints from doctors that I was bringing the medical profession into disrepute by spreading so-called anti-vax disinformation, despite this evidence being very clear. I dealt with that 4 weeks, you know, and I wrote a kind of response. I had support from other people, and it was fine. They left me alone and left me with a warning, okay? So I then said, okay, what can I do here? This is around the time in the UK they also announced they were going to bring a mandate for National Health Service staff. And I knew that there was something fishy going on because, one, we've got a vaccine that has clearly potential harms of significance. We know that the virus had mutated by then and become milder. And certainly Omicron, I'll come on to that in a minute, is probably no worse than a bad flu or a bad cold. Okay. So I thought, what can I do here? Because there's a big problem and it needs to be, in my view, I thought it needs to be suspended and we need an inquiry. But it's a very difficult mountain to move. People have been indoctrinated, right? Doctors think this is completely safe and effective. So I decided that I was going to spend several months critically appraising the data and try and publish it in a medical journal. When I went on GB News,
that's right,
two Pfizer whistleblowers contacted me, right, and told me what was going on. I spent several months, went through external peer review, and then it was published a couple of months ago in the journal called Journal of Insulin Resistance. I chose that journal because, one, they don't take money from industry, and because they also allowed me to write 10,000 words. I then analyzed the information to look at, okay, what is the true benefit of the vaccine, Tucker, right? And in preventing, say, a COVID death from real-world data in the UK, which you can extrapolate around the world.
Of course.
And what I found was this. During the Delta wave, which was last year, more lethal than what we've got now, and I broke it down by age group, vaccinated versus unvaccinated. You had to vaccinate 230 people over the age of 80. Prevent one COVID death. Over the age of 80. So this is the highest risk people. 520 if you're between 70 and 80. And then it becomes into the thousands as you get younger. Now, this is during the Delta wave, which is more lethal. A chap called Carl Hennigan, Professor Carl Hennigan, who is the director of the Center of Evidence-Based Medicine in Oxford. If you're over 80 for Omicron, you have to vaccinate 7,300 people to prevent one COVID death. And then it just goes into, it becomes ridiculous. As in, the younger you get, the more people you have to vaccinate. So the question then is, what are the harms and on what quality of evidence? On the best quality evidence, something called randomized control trial data, a number of scientists, Robert Kaplan from Stanford, Peter Doshi, the associate editor of the BMJ, Joseph Freeman, lead author I've spoken to, works in New York, and he's involved in research in one of the ERs there. They were able to get access to Pfizer and Moderna's original trials and new data. So let's just put this in perspective. These are the trials that led to the approval of the vaccines in the first place, okay, based upon this data that was done by Pfizer and Moderna. They found that the risk of having a serious adverse event from the original trials, disability, life-changing event, hospitalization, was higher than being hospitalized with COVID. So serious adverse event from the vaccine, there was a higher risk in the original trials of it causing a problem than it was you were to be hospitalized.
So in other words, in layman's terms, it's more dangerous to take the vaccine than not.
For most people, that's what we've concluded. That's what I've concluded. That's how it appears. And that rate, Tucker, is at least 1 in 800 because this is from Pfizer and Moderna's own trials. One serious adverse event per 800 people.
That's Seema Malhotra there speaking on Tucker Carlson. I actually chop him down a little bit, but I mean, he manages to get pretty much all the bases. In layman's terms, as Tucker Carlson says, actually what he's saying is the cure is worse than the disease, Martin.
Well, we know that they've been looking into this mRNA technology for years. And of course, the pharmaceutical industry is always looking for super duper expensive technologies that they can foist on us. And the plandemic, because the virus was, in my view, I think it's pretty clear, was deliberately created as part of an attempt to take down the Chinese economy. They then jump in with, and they would never have been allowed to, it's quite clear, and everybody was told the normal time scale for making sure that a vaccine is safe is several years, and it involves tests on animals and all sorts of things. But because of the emergency, it was all rushed through. And as we know, Borlaug, the head of Pfizer, made a deal whereby he bought and sold his own shares in Pfizer just as the announcement was made that we're going to be allowed to go ahead and produce it for general use. And of course, the general use is paid for by the government. Yeah, if they had to sell it to individual doctors and patients, they'd never be able to make the money. So there's a money making aspect of this. There's the fact that they didn't follow, and people who took the vaccine, and I've had a Moderna vaccine, I think we knew when we were taking it that it hadn't been properly tested because it was an emergency situation, inverted commas. Now, underlying all of this, Tony, is that it's actually COVID itself is a biological warfare agent. And I think that all of this vaccination stuff is well worth talking about, but it's somewhat muddied by the fact that we have people who are very sceptical of vaccines, sceptical of basic healthcare measures like wearing masks and lockdowns. And therefore, the whole debate has become entrenched around the wrong things. Although now it's becoming clear, as I say, that COVID itself, as Jeffrey Sachs and The Lancet have uncovered, and Dashak was working for The Lancet until he didn't explain to Sachs what was going on. The Uns Review, Ron Uns, has done a pretty good job of pulling all this together. And it looks like a deliberate attack on the world population. And the vaccines are just a second tap. Now, that doesn't mean that the vaccines are safe. I'm totally perfectly prepared.
But I mean, Martin, just a minute. It's not necessarily a second tap, is it? Because it may be that this is just a whole thing is there to, well, not maybe part of a eugenics agenda, but the object is to market something new to the whole world population, to cut out a whole new market of tens of billions, hundreds of billions for the pharmaceutical industry into the future.
You're seeing it all through one lens, which is the pharmaceutical industry. The pharmaceutical industry is embedded within the financial services sector, which is embedded within the
Well, that's perfectly true. I just have to express my complete disagreement with you over masks and over. I think inside masks might be useful. Outside, I don't think they are. Lockdowns, Martin. Right, I mean, I think you've had your say. I think it's important.
Overwhelming that COVID itself was a biological.
Well, I mean, you've been saying this for the last two and a half years. That's fine, and I agree with you.
The pharmaceutical companies of the West out because they're communists and they don't believe in private healthcare. Okay.
Anyway, here. Andrew Bridgen, you may have heard about this week. He's MP for around Leicestershire somewhere, Tory MP. He's been in the news this week because he's been suspended from Parliament after breaching MPs' lobbying rules. So he's suspended for 5 days. But really, this seems to be time to coincide with his absolutely amazing speech in Parliament last week about the vaccine harms, vaccine injuries. And of course, on this programme, really, for the last, must be about 8 years, we've been talking about Andrew Wakefield. We've been talking about the possibility of the dangers of the MMR vaccine, which very few people who allow their children to be given it realise that the MMR vaccine itself as a multiple vaccine, three different vaccines all in one, haven't been tested as three vaccines in one. It's the individual vaccines on their own have been tested on kids, but not the three together. And so we've been, well, I particularly have been warning about the dangers of vaccines for many years. And of course, that was probably one of the reasons why our wonderful station manager, Pat Hart, decided to take us off the air when COVID started, even though we had broken the story back in the first show in February 2020 about this is in New Delhi, the New Delhi Virology Institute, saying that they believe that SARS-CoV-2 could not have occurred naturally, which was flying in the face of what Jeremy Farrar managed to convince the British government and the whole British establishment, including the media, was the case. But anyway, so here is Andrew Bridgen speaking last week in the Commons. I'll put the full version of this speech, I think it's about 7 or 8 minutes, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But he does, I think, a pretty good job of summarising the problems that there have been, and it's so good to actually hear him speaking under parliamentary privilege. And he is the only MP, it seems, that's really prepared to stick their neck out on this topic.
3 months ago, one of the UK's most eminent and trusted cardiologists, a man with an international reputation, Dr. Asim Malhotra, published peer-reviewed research that concluded that there should be a complete cessation in the administration of the COVID mRNA vaccines for everyone because of clear and robust data of significant harms and little ongoing benefit. He described the rollout of the biotech Pfizer vaccine as perhaps the greatest miscarriage of medical science, damage to population health, erosion of trust in public health, and attack on democracy that we will witness in our lifetime. Interesting, Madam Deputy Speaker, there's not been a single rebuttal so far in the scientific literature to Dr. Malhotra's findings, despite its widespread circulation and it making international news. Before I state the key evidence-based facts that make a clear case for complete suspension of these emergency use authorisation vaccines, it's important to appreciate the key psychological barrier as to why these facts have not been acknowledged by policymakers and taken up by the UK mainstream media. That psychological phenomenon is willful blindness. This is when human beings, including in this case institutions, turn a blind eye to the truth in order to feel safe, reduce anxiety, avoid conflict, and protect their prestige and reputations. There are numerous examples of this occurring in recent history, such as at the BBC with Jimmy Savile, the Department of Health and Midstaffs, Hollywood and Harvey Weinstein, and specifically in the medical establishment, the OxyContin scandal, which was portrayed in the miniseries Dope Stick. What's crucial to understand is that the longer willful blindness to the truth continues, the more unnecessary harm it creates. So here are the cold, hard facts on the mRNA vaccines and an explanation of the structural drivers that continue to be barriers to doctors and the public receiving independent information to make informed decisions about these vaccines. Since the rollout in the UK of the BioNTech Pfizer mRNA vaccine, we've had almost 500,000 yellow card reports of adverse effects from the public. Madam Deputy Speaker, this is unprecedented and is more than all the yellow card combined reports of the last 40 years. Such an extraordinary rate of side effects, which are beyond mild, have been reported in many countries across the world that have used the Pfizer vaccine, including, of course, the United States. We clearly need an inquiry into the influence of Big Pharma on medications and our NHS, and this has been called for on many occasions, indeed by some very, very influential people, including prominent physicians, such as the former president of the Royal College of Physicians and personal doctor to our former Queen, Sir Richard Thompson. On a separate occasion, in the last few years, these calls have been supported also and covered in the Daily Mail, The Guardian, and most recently the I newspaper. We're not just fighting for principles of ethical, evidence-based medical practice here, but we're also fighting for our democracy. The future health of the British public depends on us tackling head-on the cause of this problem and finding meaningful solutions. In 2015, a commentary by Richard Horton, editor-in-chief of The Lancet, suggested that possibly half of the published medical literature may simply be untrue. He wrote that science has taken a turn towards darkness and asked who is going to take the first step to clean up the system. Well, Madam Deputy Speaker, that first step could start this evening with this debate. It starts here, and the Vaccine Minister and the Government ensuring in the first instance that there needs to be an immediate and complete suspension of any more COVID vaccines than their use of mRNA technology. Madam Deputy Speaker, silence on this issue is more contagious than the virus itself. And I'd also, now so should courage be. And I would implore all the scientists, the medics, the nurses, and those in the media who know the truth about the harm these vaccines are causing to our people to speak out. Madam Deputy Speaker, we've already sacrificed, in my view, far too many of our citizens on the altar of ignorance and unfettered corporate greed. Last week, the MHRA authorised these experimental vaccines for use on children as young as 6 months. A report, which I've already quoted in a Westminster Hall debate some weeks ago, by the Journal of American Medical Associations, studying the effects of the COVID-19 mRNA vaccination on children under 5 years of age, showed that 1 in 200 had an adverse event, which resulted in hospitalisation and had symptoms that lasted longer than 90 days. As the data clearly shows, to anyone who wants to look at it, the mRNA vaccines, they're not safe, they're not effective, and they're not necessary. I implore the government to halt their use immediately. And as I've demonstrated, and the data clearly shows, the government's current policy on the mRNA vaccines is on the wrong side of medical ethics. It's on the wrong side of scientific data. And ultimately, Madam Deputy Speaker, it will be on the wrong side of history. Madam Deputy Speaker, it's also been brought to my attention by a whistleblower from a very reliable source that one of these institutions is covering up clear data that reveals the mRNA vaccine increases inflammation of the heart arteries. They are covering this up in fear that they may lose funding from the pharmaceutical industry. The lead of that cardiology research department has a prominent leadership role with the British Heart Foundation, and I'm very disappointed to say that he has sent out non-disclosure agreements to his research team to ensure that this important data never sees the light of day. This, Madam Deputy Speaker, is an absolute disgrace.
In a way, he's ending up there, Martin, with the blockbuster, which is that you've got, you know, everyone likes to give a bit of money to the British Heart Foundation. The guy at British Heart Foundation in charge of it is putting his staff under non-disclosure agreements to make sure that there isn't any kind of proper discussion. But anyway, I just thought that that's a fascinating insight into some of the machinations behind and the facts behind the other side of the debate, which we're not allowed to hear.
Well, I think we've got to be very careful to say that this is about mRNA vaccinations. I had AstraZeneca vaccinations, my first two vaccinations.
Yeah, it's about the UK, basically. I mean, it's been extrapolated,
yeah.
Obviously.
It's a global pandemic. Started in Wuhan in China, probably deliberately, by the US deep state. And of course, I'm quite sure that the Chinese and Russian and the Iranians said, we think this is a biological warfare attack on us, partly because the form of COVID that they got was different from the one in China. And it started at comms, which is where all the political and religious leadership of Iran congregate. And lots of their old guys died immediately. And they immediately came out, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, who is called Salami, after Soleimani was assassinated by Trump, he said, we think this is a biological warfare attack. And it was ignored in the Western media completely, because, of course, the Iranians just make stuff up.
Anyway, so at the same time, Andrew Bridgen has failed in his attempt this week to overturn a 5-day suspension from Parliament and could be in danger of losing almost a month's pay as an MP. The Conservative MP for North West Leicestershire received 2 days suspension for failing to declare that he received a paid trip to Ghana in 8 emails to ministers, and another 3 days for writing to the Standards Commissioner, Catherine Stone, asking if she had been lobbying to receive a peerage. Well, I think that's fair enough. He can write that letter. He's, most of his time that he's been suspended for is just for doing his job. The outspoken MP, he recently hit the headlines making a speech in Parliament calling for the suspension of the mRNA COVID vaccine amid concerns it could lead to inflammation to arteries and the heart, will be suspended for 5 days. So I suppose it's not too bad. It's kind of Christmas time and there wasn't probably so much going on in the Commons. But I mean, you know, this it does seem as if these two may be linked. They've decided to throw the book at him because of his antipathy to the pharmaceutical industry in the UK. Here in the UK.
Maybe. It's a reasonable supposition. But I come back to what I was saying previously. mRNA vaccines, majority of the human population haven't been given mRNA vaccines because A, they're too poor in poor countries, and in enemy countries like Russia, China, Cuba and Iran, they weren't allowed
but
to.
But apparently in Russia, they don't have any kind of yellow card scheme, so there's no reporting of side effects in Russia, apparently.
Well, the Sputnik vaccine has not been produced by Pfizer. It's been produced by the Russian medical establishment, which is basically publicly owned, same as in China. The Sinopharm vaccine wasn't produced by Western. It may be that their vaccines are similarly dangerous, but the mRNA vaccines are known to be completely new technology.
Anyway, so let's have a listen to the
deleterious effect.
James Dellingpole's Delling podcast, whatever they call it these days. He spoke to Andrew Bridgen this week about this whole topic of this research by Malhotra and others that that he's been picking up, and also what's happened with him being suspended.
Dr. Malhotra has produced his paper. He claims that, you know, this is a huge scandal, that there are massive harms and minimal benefits from the mRNA vaccines. They're causing harm it's going to be the biggest issue that's going to hit healthcare in our lifetimes. It's a challenge to democracy, and that no one's come out and actually rebutted any of his claims. And how have we got into this situation? By willful blindness. And we've seen examples of where individuals or institutions have decided to turn a blind eye to what they can see going on for various reasons of having a quiet life, not wanting conflict, to protect their own reputations from attack potentially. And, you know, things like, you know, how did Jimmy Savile perpetrate all his crimes for decades in the BBC when everyone knew about it, but no one did anything? And, you know, and Harvey Weinstein in Hollywood, or you know, various things like that. Or how did mid-staffs happen and no one in the NHS actually said anything? All the practices that were going on there for so long.
Did you mention all stuff in your, is it all
or,
in your speech?
Or indeed the Antikontin scandal, which was brought out in the mini-series Dope Stick, where, you know, a medicine that was harming people was allowed to be passed out and continued and covered up for.
So he's kind of repeating what he was saying in the speech there for James Dellingpole. Nothing much new there, but actually there is some quite fascinating deep insight later on in that, and I'll put a link up to the whole Dellingpole podcast with Andrew Bridgen on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. And Andrew has been there right the way through all this, and he describes what was going on when these big announcements were being made by the likes of Matt Hancock and the scientific advisors. What were those? I can't even remember their names now. Anyway, those scientific advisors by Boris Johnson back in March, April 2020, and right way up till pretty much just before the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians, which seems to have now be concentrated in the minds of the deep state rather than COVID. So let's have a listen to Andrew Bridgen's insight into what was going on in these presentations we were given on the television.
Yeah, they knew all the science in number 10. They have all the up-to-date figures about everything. And, you know, they're telling us one story on the media, and they're also then telling us that there was no social there was no social distancing, no masks, party, and let rip. And also, I always try and be as pleasant as possible with the people I come into contact with. I think, you know, I get interviewed a lot. I know a lot of BBC cameramen, and you know, some of them have come to me and said, you know, during the lockdown, you know, the mandates the BBC were given to go into number 10, you know, you've got to have all these tests for COVID. Only one person allowed in, so that the cameraman was having to do the sound as well for all those staged presentations of Project Fear to the public and Witty and whoever was on that day. And he said, if I'd done all that, and I'm there filming and recording, he said, if I'd swung the camera around, behind the camera, there were dozens and dozens of advisors not wearing masks, not socially distancing, and just lounging around.
Okay.
So then, clearly, it was a play.
So a play, Martin, apparently.
Well, you can interpret it in two different ways. The fact is, they were telling everybody that they needed to social distance and wear masks. And plenty of people did in good faith. Don't forget, they've been given something to, they've been asked to do something, and they're doing it in good faith, like in the Blitz, when you're asked to put that light out, people put the light out.
Yeah, but it wasn't the Blitz, was it? It wasn't the Blitz.
No, it was worse than the Blitz, Tony, because it's a plandemic. This debate has moved on since the war in Ukraine started. It's about warfare. What Jeremy Sachs has uncovered is that it was a deliberate, created virus, and it was deliberately released. And that's why in China they've stopped doing it. That's why they had lockdowns and masks, and in Iran, and in Cuba, and in countries with no mRNA vaccines whatsoever.
Well, I mean, once they Martin, you're shouting, and I'm going to intervene, I'm afraid. Martin, I'd just like to say about, you know, the masks business, that if the various researchers and doctors had been listened to about the benefits of chloroquine and ivermectin, there would have been no need for any of this. And anyway, vast amounts of the population who were not actually vulnerable to dying of COVID were locked down unnecessarily and told that they had to use masks pointlessly.
We're not going to agree about this. I think it is a plandemic. A plandemic.
Well, I agree, but it's also a psychological. Martin, it's also a psychological warfare operation as well as a plandemic.
Yes, a psychological warfare operation on the Chinese, and it's not just psychological warfare; it's real warfare. But in China, up to now, they've had less than 6,000-7,000 deaths. It's going to go up now because they've changed the policy.
And it's also a psychological. It's also a psychological warfare operation on the press and on the public.
Warfare, Tony. It's warfare.
Also, I said, Martin, you need to listen. I said, it's also. It was also, Martin. It was also a psychological warfare operation on the press and on the public.
Well, that's the this whole thing is part of World War III. So it's a deliberate release. What they hoped the Chinese would do was make mistakes in their handling of it. They were quite happy for it to flow back over the rest of the world population so that they could then bring in the lockdowns, mess up the lockdowns as it did in this country, and then people are willing to accept vaccines as a way out of lockdowns. All of that is clear. But the fundamentals of this is that COVID itself is a deliberate biological warfare attack. As the Iranian general staff, they immediately pointed the finger. And what they did in Iran, they went to war. They put masks on, they locked down, as they did in China. And the problem with Britain is that when COVID came along, you've got libertarian Tory MPs who were constantly lobbying, and Rishi Sunak was one of them, constantly lobbying against taking sensible health measures.
So the students here in Bristol that went to COVID parties to catch COVID deliberately were wrong.
They got prosecuted for it, and they were fined, weren't they?
Were they right or wrong?
They were wrong.
Okay. Well, I want the audience to be clear what your position is.
Because you're opposed to lockdowns ideologically.
No, that's not. What do you mean? Okay, so when you say ideologically, well, I'm opposed to them medically. I don't think they were necessary. But anyway, what do you mean by ideologically?
You're not a medical doctor. And in any case, if you walk around...
Neither are you. Neither are you. Can you explain what you mean by I'm opposed to them ideologically? What do you mean by that?
You have got a libertarian philosophy, okay? The idea that the government is trying to tell us what to do, so the obvious thing to do is we just disobey the government.
Well, if this was anthrax, I would agree we need to have a lockdown.
You say, well, we could just have locked down the elderly, but people don't live in bubbles where the elderly are over here and we're over there. And it's no use saying, well, we can't. If you were going to do that, then people couldn't have visited.
Well, yes, the Swedes did that, didn't they? The Swedes did that.
The whole point
anyway, Martin,
exactly.
I think you've put your point across. You've put your point across. Thank you very much for it. We've seen also that, of course, the government at the time, Boris Johnson's government, was brought down by, effectively, even though he didn't want to admit it. In fact, there was, I'm not sure the guy's name, was it Alex Allen, that told the Houses of Parliament that Boris Johnson may have broken the ministerial code by a party gate. But anyway, we've got now, finally, after all that time, is it 6-8 months or so, there is a new advisor on ministerial behaviour, and guess who it is?
The Prime Minister has appointed a new advisor on ministerial behaviour. Sir Laurie Magnus is a veteran banker and currently chairs the public body Historic England. The role, which involves investigating possible breaches of the ministerial code, has been vacant since Lord Gait quit earlier this year, having suggested Boris Johnson may have broken the rules. Rishi Sunak has been criticised for not strengthening the advisor's remit. Our political correspondent Jonathan Blake reports.
While Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, two advisers on ministers' interests resigned. Sir Alex Allen, when Mr Johnson overruled his findings into alleged bullying by the then Home Secretary, Priti Patel, and Lord Gait, who questioned whether the Prime Minister himself had broken the rules over parties at Downing Street during lockdown. Since June, the role has been vacant. Now, Rishi Sunak has appointed Sir Laurie Magnus, who's worked in financial services for 40 years and is a former chairman of the National Trust. The Prime Minister said he had the integrity and experience to command the trust and confidence of ministers. Sir Laurie said he would endeavour to act with fairness and integrity. Only the Prime Minister can order an investigation to begin, and the adviser does not have the power to set punishments. Dave Penman is the General Secretary of the FDA Union, representing civil servants.
Rishi Sunak had a real opportunity here to reset the relationship between ministers and civil servants, to actually put action behind those words that he said as he entered Downing Street, saying he was going to lead the government with integrity. And instead of that, he's followed exactly the same path as Boris Johnson did. So essentially, he's continuity Johnson when it comes to the ministerial code.
The Conservative MP, Bernard Jenkin, who sits on the Common Standards Committee, said the role should have more power to initiate investigations where there may have been a breach of the ministerial code. Labour's deputy leader Angela Rayner said Rishi Sunak had chosen to preserve the rotten ethics regime he inherited from his predecessor and installed another toothless watchdog. Meanwhile, a lawyer appointed by the Prime Minister to consider complaints about the Justice Secretary Dominic Raab's behaviour will continue their investigation.
So this is, it's piling. I'm reminded of order from chaos, which is, there was chaos created with Boris breaking all the rules and various other people. And then what they've done is they've actually brought in one of their own people, a banker this time, some guy from the National Trust. Now, we've covered much of the rather awful behaviour of the National Trust over the last few years, the fact that they don't really adhere to any of their charitable status. They're behaving like a business. They're racking rents up. A lot of the people that are their tenants are in a terrible state. They're also trying to acquire land by all sorts of means, like putting in claims for land they don't own. So the National Trust is not a very good place for him to come from. And now this guy from a banker, has been put in charge of policing the ministers.
I think he was put in charge of the National Trust because he was a banker, because they wanted to bring the National Trust into line. That's the stuff I've been reading. Well, he's clearly just an insider appointed to, they've got to have one. So he will be it. And, they will carry on.
This is the City of London, isn't it? Just the City of London. We know, don't we? Rishi Sunak is not quite straight out of Goldman Sachs, but he's a technocrat from Goldman Sachs, which of course is the deep state NATO's favourite, Bilderberg's favourite central bank.
Well, the thing about dominant elites is that they network and they do each other favours. And that's what happens in this country. It's been going on for a very long time. Boris Johnson, of course, is being looked after well enough, despite his appalling premiership. He will not starve in his old age if he gets there. And they all look after each other. And we need to, obviously, ultimately, there's going to have to be big changes, not just in this country, but across the planet, because it's the biggest crisis since World War II. And Rishi Sunak is way out of his depth in all of this, really. I'm pretty sure we're going to come on to discuss the strikes in a moment, but he seems to be determined that he's going to not give way on any of the demands of the strikers, so that he'll go into the next election having thrashed the unions, except it may turn out to be the other way around.
Well, this is the next question. This seems to be deliberate, the provocation. There's an economic provocation gone on through the energy prices jumping up, inflation leaping, and the government... it's a little bit like Putin trying to negotiate with NATO or Zelensky. The unions trying to negotiate with the government that actually sits and rubs their hands and thinks, right, actually maybe we can cause chaos here. The lords of chaos, the lords of misrule can cause chaos here and smash the unions in the process.
Well, I understand that the rail companies were willing to put a deal of 10% on the table to the rail RMT last week. And then the government, who say that they're not involved in the dispute because it's between the private sector companies and the unions, which of course is a farce, because the private sector companies are actually, they're given their powers and their subsidies from the government, and they vetoed it. It looks as if Rishi Sunak, there's been some analysis in The Guardian about this, Rishi Sunak seems to have decided that he is not going to negotiate anything with any of these unions, and he's going to appeal to the Tory grassroots that rejected him in the ballot by saying that we are going to smash these militant unions, blah, blah, blah. I think it's a big misjudgment. The last ambulance workers' strike in 1989, I remember it because we all tried to support them in any way we could. So I remember I was working in London at the time. We all went into the streets one lunchtime and rattled our keys in support of the ambulance workers, which, because that's one of the protests that had taken place in Czechoslovakia at a similar time. And they won because they had public support on their side, and the Tory government of the day had to back down and pay them. And I think that's what will happen in this case as well, ultimately. One of the things about the Tory anti-union laws is that before you can go on strike, you've got to jump through enormous amounts of hoops, and you've got to have absolutely overwhelming support of your members before you can take them out on strike. But by the same token, you can't take them back to work without their agreement. And it's no use the Tories thinking that the union bosses, as they like to call them in the Tory media, can tell the workers to go back to work. They can't. If they're not happy, they can continue to strike. And the union leadership will have to accept that mandate, because that's the mandate they've been given in these secret ballots. So I don't think the Tories are on to a winning hand here, but it's going to cause an awful lot of suffering for ordinary people in the country. But, of course, they need, as people suffer under all of this,
Yeah, but I mean, what's going on here surely is just a discrediting of the whole democratic system. The Bilderbergers, the deep state in the background, are rubbing their hands and saying, well, as this collapses, we're going to pick up the pieces and it's all going to be ours.
Well, but the thing is that the democratic system never really existed. It's a myth because it's an oligarchic system. And, so when people say, well, we used to have freedom, it's like, when was that?
Well, I think, Martin, let's just be clear about this. The Parliament and the government have managed over the years, many, many times, to push back against big business when they've tried to muscle in. It's just that they're now in the last stages of losing that battle.
It's long gone, isn't it? It's long gone. In my lifetime, I've seen all of those advances that were made cancelled out. And that's been the project of the deep state, big capital, the wealthy classes, ever since the welfare state was originally created. They just don't like it, and they want to get rid of it. And the crises in the health service now, and of course the strikes aren't helping to dealing with the day-to-day crises, but I think most ordinary people realise that ambulance workers are going on strike for their service. They haven't got enough ambulances. The whole question of not being able to let people out of hospitals because there is no... The care system was privatised. It used to be run by local authorities. You would go to a local authority care home and be looked after. Not anymore. they go bust, these care homes.
So the Bilderbergers, as I say, sitting rubbing their hands, waiting for it all to fall to pieces. And people like Rishi Sunak, of course, and Goldman Sachs being on their side, not on our side. We'll hopefully, in a couple of weeks' time, when we're back in the new year, have a report, because we have had it confirmed. The Bilderberg Conference will be taking place in Lisbon in 2023. So that is at the end of May, beginning of June. Not quite sure of dates yet. And wouldn't be nice to be able to actually report in 2023 from Portugal, from the Bilderberg Conference itself. I will certainly set that as my aim for 2023. I don't know if you can manage to make it over there, Martin. I don't know if you even think it's worth it. Who are these Bilderbergers?
Well, they are one of the networking forums for the powers that be. It's not the only one, though.
But it's what makes it interesting to me is they're very close links to NATO.
Yes, it's the Western deep state who are the real criminals here. There isn't a global conspiracy. There is a Western deep state conspiracy. But, of course, they've now got very powerful opponents. You're not just talking about countries like Bangladesh, which can be pushed around, or little countries like Nicaragua, which can, as some US guy some years ago said, every decade or so, we have to throw some small country against the wall just to show we mean business. And they've been doing things like that. And they got even more arrogant after the collapse of the Soviet Union. They are now facing peer competition from Russia and China, and they don't really know what to do about it. And because they're not part of this system. They're not. It's a different...
We're going to be talking about Ukraine a bit more in part two, but Russia-Ukraine war. Henry Kissinger calls for a negotiated peace in Ukraine. Kiev dismisses his proposal. Electricity has been restored to 6 million, says Zelensky, as the Russian defence minister visits troops involved in the invasion. So it looks as if at least... the work by the Russians in destroying a lot of the electricity over in Ukraine has led Henry Kissinger to come out again, saying that he thinks that it's important to negotiate peace to reduce the risk of another devastating world war. But the Kiev government has dismissed his comments as appeasing the aggressor and said that there will be no deal which involves ceding territory. Well, that means obviously that there will be no deal, because there's no way that Zelensky, even with the help of NATO, is going to take back that territory from Russia now. I think it's very unlikely, Martin, isn't it?
It is, and I wouldn't suggest that Kissinger is saying this because of the recent military developments. Kissinger, and there is clearly some talk at the top in the US that we can't. I mean, for example, one of the things that happened is when Zelensky went to the Congress yesterday or the day before, quite a lot of the Republicans didn't turn up to hear the speech. And when the new year comes, they're going to, before they send any more money to Ukraine, they're going to ask what's happened to the previous money. And of course, they may well ask, because most of it hasn't actually gone on weaponry at all. It's just gone into the pockets of Ukrainian oligarchs and their allies in the US. And of course, into the pockets of Lockheed Martin and the other suppliers of weaponry. The things are coming to a head on a massive scale. And it isn't just about the Ukraine. Don't forget Russia's foreign assets, hundreds of billions of dollars have been seized.
It's interesting you brought that up, because it was the subject of Catherine Austin Fitz this week. She was talking about where all this... I mean, there is a lot of consternation in the United States about the vast amount of money which is going to Ukraine. Not necessarily because the money's going, but because there are no checks and balances on it at the moment. And she has some ideas about why that might be.
My question is, how much of the money that got sent to the Ukraine just came laundered right back for the election?
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
So, you know, to me, the Ukraine is just, it's not a destination point. It's a throughput point. Do you know what I mean?
You think that's $45 billion just going to get laundered right back into the Democrats, to the...
God knows where all that money is going, but it's like that you send weapons to the Ukraine and then the plane crashes on the way to Bangladesh. You know, did it go to the Ukraine for use, or did it go to the Ukraine to be auctioned off and sold around the world? I mean, point, you know, I hate to say it, we're in full scale implosion. The corruption is that bad. And that's why I'm telling you, what we need is sovereignty. The federal government is not going to deliver it. If you look at the sort of where the financial coup is, and I'm happy to discuss that, but we should probably do another show. But the financial coup has reached a point where if you want sovereignty, the only person who I believe can deliver that is your state governor and legislature, and you better stop paying any attention to Trump and Biden and start paying a huge amount of attention. If you've got a great state AG, if you've got great leadership in your state legislator, if you've got a great governor, you better start supporting them. You better start organizing and supporting them, because they are the people who can protect your sovereignty, and you need governmental sovereignty if you're going to have individual sovereignty. And you better do it now. You have no more time to play let's be entertained by Donald Trump and Joe Biden and Hunter.
Do you think the federal government could implode?
The government, the federal government right now is imploding. It's, well, I should say this, it's being imploded. But you have to understand, Greg, there is no federal government. What there is a big money flow, the biggest money flow in the world. And you have operations that are run by private corporations and private banks. Everything in Washington is now run by contractors who are mostly defense contractors and the New York Fed member banks and the banks. Okay? So the central banks and corporations are running everything. And the Department of Defense has finally issued what used to be called the JEDI contract, but it's a $9 billion cloud contract. And once they implement that contract, it gives them the ability, the banks and the IT contractors, the ability to completely reorganize and re-engineer the entire federal government, you know, basically through cloud systems, which steal your money and destroy what's remaining of your sovereignty. And that's why, unless we have the state standing up for us, we are in real serious trouble. That's going to be in 2023 and 2024. So, you know, we have continued to finance this operation despite the fact that it was breaking all the laws and engaged, you know, in what a staffer in the Senate said to me in 2001 was, you know, the U.S. government is being run as a criminal enterprise. I was a Senate staffer in the Appropriation Committee in 2001. We've tolerated and financed criminal enterprise for 20 plus years. There's a coup. This is a coup.
So that's the voice of Catherine Austin Fitz, the wonderful, the fantastic Catherine Austin Fitz. What she's saying there, Martin, is it actually this money that's going over to Ukraine may not just be going to gangsters in Europe, but it may actually be bouncing back to the United States.
Yeah, undoubtedly the case. I mean, in a straightforward way, don't forget all this, all of the contracts that are given to the arms industry to supply the Ukraine. That's money in the pockets of those companies straight away. Just before the Defense Intelligence Agency of the United States warned the Israeli Defense Forces of a pandemic coming out of China in November 2019, in September 2019, there was another 2008. But we didn't know it at the time because systems have been put in place to bail out the repo market, which is exactly what happened. And then BlackRock, which is a private hedge fund, took over the Federal Reserve of the United States of America, and they decided which companies were going to be bailed out, all of which was carried out without any scrutiny and transparency at all. The excuse was, we don't want to panic the markets, so we will basically bail the markets out under the table without anybody officially knowing about it in on the elected side of the government. And at that point, they took over. The Federal Reserve was always really controlled by the private banks, but BlackRock took over the role of the Federal Reserve, and they decided who should and should not be bailed out.
Well, back in 1986,
it's very coincidental that we then have the attack on China following in the November. When she says it's a coup, that was where the coup took place,
but
just there.
Back in 1986, we had this thing called Iran-Contra, didn't we, where it was shown that the military were using, basically military equipment for creating slush funds, smuggling Class A drugs around the world and selling them, and then using that money to fund their own operations. It sounds to me as if what may be going on in Ukraine is just another extension of that. The idea is, look, we sell this as a great idea to Congress. Isn't it terrible what's happening to Ukraine? They give us loads of money, and then we just funnel it into our own coffers for black operations and for organized crime.
Yes, I mean, it's this has been going on for a very long time. The more you look back into the history of it, the more you realise that this is basically the modus operandi of these groups going back to the Second World War and before. But it's now coming to a head because there's a general crisis of a capitalist system in general. You know, even if you didn't have all these crims in charge, it would be creating a problem because new technologies like the internet and so on cannot be monetized directly. Therefore, you have to, you get these speculative bubbles because they can't actually deal with the productivity increases that the internet might cause because you can't make, that's why the dot-com bubble collapsed because they couldn't monetize what was going on. And therefore, they then move into speculative investments in real estate and so on. And the whole system eventually becomes one big Ponzi scheme.
It certainly does. No, it certainly does. It's organised crime. Terry Hall there died this week, age 63. That was one of the first iterations of him, the specials. I dread to think what the future will bring when we're living in real gangster times. Well, Terry, a bit of a prophetic message, Martin, there, wasn't there? And also, of course, very popular. I'm sure you enjoyed the music at the time.
I did. They were very, very influential on people of my generation. I'm exactly the same age as he is. And, of course, what was very important was the whole two-tone movement which came out of Coventry was the unity between black and white youth listening to versions of black music.
Yeah, very important, isn't it?
Because the rejection of racist thuggery.
Even then, the deep state, it seemed to be trying to pit various races against each other here in the UK, you know, by fueling white supremacism and the far right here in Britain. Even more so in the States, probably.
It's part. I mean, you know, the obviously the deep state has got its machinations, but it's also just a part of the culture. Don't forget, Britain was an imperialist country, and people did have a, you know, the British are best, the British are best, they wouldn't give tuppence for all of the rest. With, you know, people for generations were brought up with that. And therefore, it's, you know, that doesn't mean that everybody's racist and they don't realise it. But, I mean, the fact is that in reality, Britain, at the height of the empire, was a racist entity. Hitler admired the British Empire. He admired it. He thought it was great.
And actually, of course, it was part of the culture in the time of the First World War, right up to the Second World War. You know, that was racism was normal. You know, they were all, it was completely normal to talk about other races as, you know, the kind of, I suppose the Nazi equivalent would be Untermensch, but there's something wrong with all these other people. The British are the best as part of the way of building up the empire. You're quite right. But then around about, I think it was 1981, the Specials released Ghost Town, which is probably one of their most famous. But then after that, Terry Hall split with them and created something which I think in some ways is my favourite version of the various groups that he had, called Fun Boy 3. From 1982, the Fun Boy 3 with the Lunatics have taken over the asylum. It's actually a lot of Terry Hall's lyrics and the direction of his music came from the fact that he revealed much more recently that he suffered lifelong depression after being abducted. He always had that kind of, you know, moribund look about him, like sort of looking down at the floor kind of thing. After being abducted and sexually abused at the age of 12, he later became addicted to the drug Valium that he was prescribed following a suicide attempt in 2004. So he died of pancreatic cancer on the 18th of December. That's this week. So, Martin, I don't want to get too, you know, necessarily too much into the psychology of this, but it's almost as if at age 12, Terry had a brush with just how bad people can be. And obviously he wasn't satisfied in any way, the way that that was dealt with, picked up. So he had a complete kind of mistrust of authority as a result of that. And that kind of may have been one of the sparks for the music that we got from him.
And that's the first I've heard of that, so I don't really, I couldn't really comment. I mean,
it was a pretty horrific experience for him. He was abducted for, I think, 4 days, taken over to France, sexually abused for 4 days, and then left effectively to die by the side of the road in France. And that wasn't a particularly, it must have had a massive effect on him psychologically and left him, as I just said, with lifelong depression. So, I mean, that's, I'm not asking you necessarily to comment about that, but it might have had a massive effect on his lack of, when you can see that the authorities just fail to deal with something like that, then you don't trust them, do you?
No, and you don't trust people in general. And a lot of great art has been produced out of suffering. Not always. You know, some great artists have quite happy lives, but frequently they have quite difficult lives, and the art is, in a way, a part of coming to terms with the darker side of life.
Terry Hall had a romantic relationship with Jane Wiedlin of the Go-Go's, apparently in 1980. They co-wrote the song Our Lips Are Sealed, which we're going to hear now. He had 2 sons with his first wife, Jeanette Hall, and another son with his second wife, Lindy Hayman. But let's have a listen to that now, because that this is one of my favourite, all-time favourites, actually, Our Lips Are Sealed, because it's all about coping with child sexual abuse in an when the authorities just don't care, whether it's the police, the Home Office, the children's homes or whatever.
When we lose the fear, it doesn't matter what they
1983. That's good old Terry Hall there. A song he co-wrote with Jane Wiedlin from the Go-Go's. I think one of their best. Brilliant bit of poetry as well as a terrific tune. That's Our Lips Are Sealed. The final song I'd like to play from Terry. It was the next iteration, which is a band called The Colour Field, and this one, very few people kind of know that he did all these things, and I suppose he went further kind of into obscurity. In fact, I remember this Colour Field thing coming out just around about the same time as The Clash's Sandinista, listening to it almost, well, not obsessively quite, but, you know, loving it when it came out. And this one here is from The Colour Field called Pushing Up the Daisies from 1985. So that was The Colour Field, Terry Hall, singer-songwriter, 1985 was the date. And that was the final one of his main, I suppose, when he was really successful. A great little song. And Martin, I mean, I think when somebody like this passes away, I get, you know, particularly kind of nostalgic for the entire industry. As we've heard in this, on this program several times from different people involved in the music industry, it's basically being shut down, you know, hijacked, taken over. I think it was James Adlington, who was on this program a couple of years ago, giving us a real, you know, detailed insight into how it actually worked behind the scenes for him, and the things that they wanted to do with owning his own his artistic and creative talent ability. He just refused to sign contracts, and of course then you don't get the all that time and effort and the contacts put into your songs topping the charts, and you don't get all the money that's needed for the big tours and this kind of thing and the marketing that goes with that. The Specials, having said that, they were absolutely clear at the time, and the atmosphere and the territory was like that in the late 1970s, that actually you could, just a small band, could get properly heard. Nowadays, no chance at all, and most of the music industry is just churning out stuff like it's churning out sausages from a factory.
Well, I think you're right that there was a change in the way the music industry functioned in the 80s, and it was partly to do with the institutions like the BBC and John Peel meant that you could have somewhere where you could, and don't forget there wasn't huge variety of methods that you could hear music. You could hear it on the BBC, on the radio, and basically the sort of bands we used to listen to, we'd be on the John Peel show.
Actually, you're quite right. The Specials did premiere.
And of course, there wasn't anything else.
That you,
so everybody had to listen to John Peel because that's all there was.
The Specials.
What that led to.
The Specials. Martin, can I just, before you get off the topic, the Specials did actually launch their career on the back of a Peel session.
Yes, as many others did. And the point about that is you had public service broadcasting basically opening up the possibility of all sorts of different people making records. And the technology of making records meant, like, I mean, I used to hang out with Zounds, who were a minor anarchist punk band, and they had a rough trade. Rough Trade was the label that they were on. But these small labels grew up, and there was a way to create a music industry. You know, the whole punk new wave thing was a different way of financing the industry. And it was a rebellion against supergroups like the Rolling Stones and Queen and so on. And you actually knew the people who were in the bands. They weren't just people that were sort of in some faraway universe somewhere.
Well, that whole thing seemed to be shut down.
That changed at the time. But of course, yeah, ultimately, it's a constantly evolving thing. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of good stuff going on now, but it's very difficult to because there's so much of it. You can't possibly, I mean, it was very concentrated.
Well, what I'm saying is, Martin,
you wanted to know what everybody was doing.
The mainstream, look, let's cut to the chase. The mainstream media actually actively shut it out. They just don't, you know, they go for anything that's political.
It's as it says in the Clash song, you think it's funny, turning rebellion into money. And of course, what's happened is that the big companies have adapted to the new environment. And, you know, there's all sorts of changes going on because of live streaming and all the rest of it. And it's, in fact, people have to do, bands have to do live tours now because they can't make money from selling records.
There was a get together of the Specials, and they actually produced a protest song album, which sounds really good. I couldn't hear, you can only hear sort of little intros to the songs. And it's, one of them is Freedom Highway, but 2021, the Specials in October, got together and released an album of protest songs. I'm sure it'd be nice to maybe play some of those on future weeks. But we're going to move on now to look at, generally staying on this theme of the media and the control of it. So that's the music industry we're talking about there, the sausage factory that they've now created out of people's talent. What about BitChute? Because this week we've had the horrible news. Actually, it's a story that's been going on for a couple of years. But BitChute, Ray Vahi, who's the founder of BitChute, has been talking to an old friend of mine from the Bilderberg conferences, Dan Dix at Press for Truth, all about how HSBC have gone and closed his bank account a couple of years ago. Well, he's been trying to go through the various processes, complaints, ombudsman, things like that, to get his money back. And here he's finally decided, look, we're getting nowhere with this, so let's just talk, put out an appeal to try and fund what we're doing at BitChute because of the intransigence of the banks basically stealing his money.
So we got on notice and we found another bank, and we went through all the application, everything was looking good, and then we came to transfer the money from HSBC to the new bank. And then as the money reached the new bank, they contacted us and said, we're shutting down your account as well. Actually, at the time, I was pretty naive because I thought, oh, that's just really bad luck. Like, what happened? That's really strange. But given later events, which I'll come to, I'm leaning more towards there's an activist in HSBC who really doesn't like us. Right. So the money went back to HSBC, but by the time it arrived there, we'd already run out of our notice period, so we no longer had access to any accounts. And it went into holding at HSBC. So we eventually got a new account. That was quite difficult for us to get another new account. And then we tried to get HSBC to transfer to that account. And then we just had met endless, being run around in circles. We couldn't get them to do that. So we opened a complaint. We went through the HSB complaint process, because that's something you have to do in order to progress it to the next level. That didn't work. We actually took it to arbitration after that. In the UK, we've got something called a banking ombudsman, which is arbitration. So, so we filed our complaint with him, with the ombudsman department. And that was just an extraordinary wait. Because of COVID, it was just went on for over a year before we got assigned someone to look at our case. So all through this time, we were just waiting for, and it wasn't like we sort of knew the date. We were just phoning up and saying, is our case nearly going to be heard? And they were sort of saying, oh, there's another delay. And it was like, maybe another month, it was pushed back.
Now all this time, you could have been reinvesting into the business, doing your bandwidth, all the things you have to be doing. It's been slowing you down all this time.
Right. Yeah, so HSBC had that money in holding the whole time. I mean, they could have just transferred it at any point. It's our money. They're not even disputing that it's our money. They know it's our money. So we got assigned a arbitrator in November, so very recently, and then there was the whole back and forth. We got to fill out questions. So there's the issue of the money, and we're also bringing up an issue of what we believe is political discrimination, because we think that they've shut us down solely because we're a free speech site, and that is political discrimination. So I'll leave that to one side for the moment, because the money first. So they asked us, what is your new bank? So that HSBC has somewhere to send it. So then we sent them the details of the bank we'd had for 18 months at that point. And then we waited, and within about 7 days, the new bank contacted us that they were suspending our account without notice.
So that's the point at which Ray Vahi from BitChute, founder of BitChute, decided he was going to go public about this, because they've done all they're supposed to do. They've gone through all the regulations, Martin, and they've been told, no, you're still not going to get your money back. Effectively, HSBC have just frozen it for their own use.
Well, you sent me an email about this week, and I didn't know about it before. Well, we know that there's a massive attack going on free speech on the internet. It's been going on for several years now. You can defund people, you bar them on community guidelines and all the rest of it. So the initial promise that everybody would just have access to information without filters has gone. But nevertheless, it's still possible to. There's so much stuff out there now. That's another thing that makes it difficult for people to focus, because there's so much of distraction material as well. So, you know, people use the internet to look at pictures of kittens playing piano rather than to find out what's going on.
Well, that's what I think they seem to want. I mean, I think we're talking here about the sort of golden age of music back in the 70s there, with golden age of TV in the 70s and 80s, golden age of the internet up till now. But there is definitely an attempt to, now on YouTube have closed down all the discussions about vaccine harm and things like that. Ofcom have closed them down on the, on the radio and on the television. The press regulators have put a lot of pressure on, as we heard earlier on. The BBC, for example, told Andrew Bridgen that he wasn't going to be able to, that the local radio stations weren't going to be allowed to interview him because he had views which were not pro-vaccine, these sorts of things. Actually, HSBC, I remember interviewing some chap over in Hong Kong, I think it was years ago, must be about 4 or 5 years ago. He was a journalist who'd been working there for years, saying, oh, well, yeah, of course, Singapore, you know, any of their political opponents, they just use legal and financial means to shut them down. I mean, they just, as soon as they become an opponent, they then get shut down. HSBC, and Peter Oborne has been writing about this for a while. This particular article's in the Middle East Eye. British bank HSBC has told customers in the UK it is stopping processing any standing order payments to the Palestine aid charity Interpal. The bank sent out letters earlier this month to account holders who make regular donations in support of the London-based charity, informing them that any payments would stop on the 17th of May. It gave no reason for it. The move from HSBC will come as particularly heavy and bitter blow to Interpal. It's been announced during Ramadan, when traditionally Muslims give much more than any other period during the year. HSBC seems to think it runs the show, doesn't it? So, you know, it's going to just cut off any bank accounts of people it doesn't like. But that doesn't seem to be legal to me.
Well, legal is what you can get away with, isn't it? The history of HSBC, of course, is very pertinent here. It was set up by Jardine Matheson, who were the original opium traders into China that provoked two wars with the Chinese Empire to force them to accept British opium. And that's where their core capital came from. So, you know, the leopard doesn't change its spots too much, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't. The banks, I suppose, I mean, I call them banksters all the time now these days, but it does seem as if we've got, an attempt by the banks. We had a whole load of, I think it was, wasn't it 80 bank deaths of bankers, or maybe 90 deaths of bankers, which was, catalogued by a blogger that I interviewed. I remember he said no one else had bothered to interview him. Bankers being executed, supposedly committing suicide, a lot of them, but deaths of bankers. And the banking industry now seems it just wants to. This is the Fourth Reich. It's a financial empire, and it just buys up or shuts down any opposition, Martin. That seems where we are right now.
Well, the system is coming to its crisis point at the same time as overreaching itself and all the rest of it. On a minor note, you've got the Chancellor of the Exchequer, James Hunt, who's saying that we're going to deregulate the city and allow them to be more competitive. Because now we're outside the European Union, this is one of the advantages that we can now do what we want, and we can deregulate the City of London so that the investment banking and retail banking no longer have to be separated. They just push all these forces. Well,
yes, I know, and it's difficult to know what to do about it. But Ray Vahey at BitChute finished, and I put the full interview with Dan Dix at Press for Truth in Canada with him up on our show page. It's a shame it's quite echoey, but anyway, you can still hear exactly what he's saying. He says this is what he thinks, his advice for people that want to counter this power of the banksters.
This is a kind of strange situation where we have money, and it's locked in two separate bank accounts that we just can't use. So the idea was that we set up a Give, Send, Go account to get some money in quickly so that we've got liquidity just to make sure that we can pay our bills pay for servers, pay for everything. And I wasn't sure what the reception would be when we put it out, because, you know, it's a crazy thing to say, hey, we've got money, but we just can't access it. But it's been phenomenal so far. We've had so much support, so much encouragement. We actually set the target at £100 because I wasn't even sure what people would say, what they would do. But at the last check, I think it was like 12,000 UK pounds. So people have really stepped up to support us, and I'm very grateful to everyone who has.
Yeah, that's fantastic, you know, because the truth resonates with people. And when you're doing something like what you're doing for all the right reasons, that's going to attract people to support the effort moving forward. So that's great to hear that it's been going well.
And it's really also about bringing attention to this, because we sat on this for quite a while thinking we're going to go for the ombudsman route. We're going to wait to see what happens. We'll eventually get our money back. But it's now almost been 2 years. This is ridiculous. People need to know that this is going on, because, you know, today it's happening to us, but it's going to happen to more and more people. And these banks are just out of control. And maybe the only thing that they do respond to is activism back at them. So, you know, people feel encouraged to contact them, tell them that you have dissatisfaction with what they're doing. Yeah, I mean, that's maybe what we have to do going forward, because, they seem like they're really above the law. And look at HSBC as an example. I mean, they're a disaster of a bank in other ways. They've been fined for laundering drug money. They've been fined for all sorts of things. So, you know, for them to say reputational risk for a company that supports freedom of expression when they've done such atrocious things over and over again is just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It should be a reputational risk for them to shut down a company that supports freedom of expression. That should be the real reputational risk. And I think that's something we're going to have to do better at, that sort of activism, to make companies aware that there is going to be some sort of fallout if they start doing this stuff. And maybe that's the way we stop them from doing it.
BitChute superstar Ray Vahey there. Final clip from him. The full version of that interview with Dan Dix at Press of Truth will be up on our show page, echoey though it is, at thisweek.org.uk later on. Martin, it is in, you know, what do you make of this? You know, my little concept here of the Fourth Reich, I base it really on Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, who talks about the Nazi wealth from Switzerland, etc., that they'd squirreled away, being laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell's law firm, the Dulles Brothers law firm, and then Bormann putting it into these 750 companies that he'd set up, many of them with Jews as the chief executive, to disguise the fact that that was Nazi money that had started these companies.
Well, I mean, somebody once said, behind every great fortune lies a great crime. And the history of capitalism, and, you know, in the 19th century, when Britain was forcing its way into China, and then the scramble for China took place, and the Boxer Rebellion in 1900, where foreign forces came and put it down, from Japan, Russia, Britain, the US, everybody piled in there. And that wasn't directly related, you know, that's where HSBC's history lies. And of course, they were also, as he points out, convicted of money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels, where they were actually, you know, they'd actually created special places where they could put suitcases through of money, and they'd created little portals for these suitcases. And they were found guilty. And then Green, who was the head of HSBC at the time, was then appointed as Cameron as his advisor on tax policy. So that was the punishment. And, the banking system collapsed in 2008 because of criminality. Peter Galbraith, the economist's son of John Kenneth Galbraith, said this was literally criminal behavior, and loads of people should have been sent to prison. And if you don't send them to prison, they will carry on being criminal. You've got to do it. And even in the 1980s, with the collapse of the savings and loans industry in the United States, 1,000 people were sent to prison. The Pecora Commission in the 1930s sent loads of top bankers to prison for criminal behavior. That didn't happen in 2008. And that just shows the change in the power of the or between the, between the, these two eras.
Well, 8 or 10 years ago, I interviewed a chap called Idris Francis. He'd retired from a successful business career, and he said, I think it was said about him that he spent most of his retirement turning up to be annoying and campaigning against the European Union. But he had this to say to me when I spoke to him before he died. About his uncle, Idris Evans, who was on escort duty back in 1946 at the Nuremberg trials.
I'm Idris Francis, and having voted yes in 1975, I suddenly woke up in 1992 at the time of Maastricht to realise what the EU really was. It wasn't a free trade area. It's a political takeover of the continent by people we have never elected and we can't remove. It is a wholly corrupt, dishonest, devious, totalitarian organization, the like of which we have fought against for hundreds of years. And I, for one, am not prepared to put up with it. I set up my own company and I sold out in 1994 to retire to become a full-time nuisance to people who tell lies. My uncle, whom I knew well until he died sadly young in 1960 at the age of 46. I knew him from the early 50s when he used to come down to stay with us in Cardiganshire. Very brilliant character who, amongst other things, knew David Niven. But in terms of what actually happened at Nuremberg, he was a major in the Royal Artillery and he was stationed in Hamburg.
What exactly did these German generals say then?
Well, the words, as I remember them, yes, you have beaten us again for the second time, but next time we will win. Next time, it'll all happen so slowly, you won't realise that it's happening until it's all over.
So that's the words of a cheeky German general being escorted at the Nuremberg trials to Idris's uncle, Idris Evans. At least that's what his uncle told him, Martin.
Well, I presume that the upshot of what's being implied here is that the European Union is the reincarnation of Nazi policy.
Well, not necessarily. I think he didn't like the EU, but what he was saying was that this is, you know, I think fascinating that this is what a German had threatened, someone that was that basically, you know, you won't know what's going on until it's all over. We're coming back.
Well, if you remember in the Manning book, or maybe it was in the Op JB by...
Yeah, that's just for listeners to clarify, these two books do work very well closely together because Christopher Crichton, whose real name is John Ainsworth Davis, he died just a few years ago, his book Op JB looks at the operation handled by Ian Fleming during the war, right at the very end of the war, to bring Bormann out of Germany to Britain eventually, and handed him over to Desmond Morton, who was Winston Churchill's private secretary, just on one of the rivers on the border between the Russian zone at the end of the war and the British zone. And then he came back to London. Bormann stayed here for a short time and then went out to South America, mainly to Paraguay and Argentina. And that's where Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, picks up the story and talks about the long-term money laundering operation. And even Ladislas Fraga, can't remember the guy's name, but he was an ex... it was a Daily Express journalist, actually published in the Daily Express in the 1970s, a picture of Martin Bormann taken in Buenos Aires. And it certainly does. I mean, you know, maybe I should put that up on my show page as a sort of Christmas bonus, is this amazing photograph. And you look at it, it does look like an aged Bormann over in Buenos Aires. And then apparently he died in the 1980s or late 70s sometime. But, you know, this whole operation you can look at the Second World War simply as a way of occupying the entire continent and looting it, Martin.
Well, I'm just to bring down to a bit to anecdotal detail, in the Manning book, he says that Bormann, in fact, sat in the gallery at Nuremberg in disguise, watching other people being scapegoated for what had happened.
Yeah, I think that's Op JB where he says that.
That's Op JB, that one. I'm trying to remember which one it was in.
It's a coup de grace at the end of the book, in a way.
Now, The Nazi networks were integrated with the Western intelligence services before the war. Yeah, because they were anti-communist.
Yeah.
So there are plenty of people in Britain, as we well know, including Edward the VII and the Queen Mum, were very sympathetic to Hitler because they saw them as, you know, bulwark against communism and all the rest
of it. Well, we had that piece a few weeks ago with Edward the VIII, actually over in Lisbon, I think it was, funnily enough, where we were talking about the Bilderbergers going there in 2023. Lisbon actually telling the German ambassador over there, saying, well, you need to start bombing London, and then that will force them to negotiate. And that was literally a week and a half or so before the Blitz began.
Yes. I mean, all of this is... I mean, Reinhard Gehlen, who is the head of Gestapo, he was interviewed by Western intelligence services at the end of the war, and he said, well, I've got loads of spies in the Soviet Union. Do you want my spy network? And they said, well, when you put it like that, the answer is definitely yes. And so he was made head of the BND, which is the West German intelligence services, the head of the Gestapo. Now, and Klaus Barbie, for example, the butcher of Lyon, who'd killed loads of French resistance people, he ended up running torture training for the Bolivian army in Bolivia, supported by the CIA.
Well, this when we start getting to the nitty-gritty.
Well, the links between what became the CIA, the OSS, and the Nazis go back to before the war. They continued during the war, and at the war's end, they were... And of course, the OUN, the Ukrainian... nationalist army, which had fought for the Germans and killed loads of Jews and Poles and other undesirables in Ukraine, many of their people were welcomed into the West at the end of the war, and a lot of them ended up in Canada, including Mr. Friedland's grandfather.
The nitty-gritty of this is surely the relationship between the new State of Israel and the Nazis, whether or not they were going to pursue those Nazis after the war. And we had John Loftus on explaining, and various other people we've had over the years talking about this fascinating deal done by Ben-Gurion, who's the first Israeli, was it president or prime minister? I'm not sure, but anyhow, he did this deal with Nelson Rockefeller, which was to do with the votes at the United Nations in order to get the State of Israel approved by the UN. And they said to Ben-Gurion, well, you can have a state or vengeance, but not both. That's what Rockefeller said to him. And so they decided, well, okay, well, we will agree not to pursue these Nazi war criminals in exchange for getting a vote to create the Israeli state at the UN, Martin.
Well, yes, there's lots of dirty deals done. I mean, another aspect of this was that... I've slipped my mind. I'm just trying to think it through. Oh yes, the trial of he was extradited from Argentina. I've forgotten it. Eichmann was extradited. You know, the Mossad went to Argentina
In the 1960s, wasn't it?
And he was put on trial in Israel. The Jewish community in Argentina then lobbied the Israelis, said, don't do that because we do very good business with these people. Yeah. Now, the
state. Don't you dare do it again, basically. Yeah.
And by and large, they haven't. I think that what's happened with, in terms of chasing up ex-Nazis, is that various people have been scapegoated but obviously no big fish.
None of the big fish. No, we had another one this week. I noticed.
Or died or whatever.
Yeah.
But of course, you'll be aware that organisations like the KGB, which have now become the FSB, were well aware of all of this all along, that the West was in fact infested with former Nazis and that the intelligence structure in the West was Nazified. That's what they knew that. They knew that. And of course, their own setup wasn't entirely free and fair and human friendly, but nevertheless, they weren't Nazified in the way that the Western intelligence structure was. They had their own sins to commit.
Yeah, I mean, so let's contrast that with the mainstream press and what they're saying this week. Is former concentration camp secretary, 97 years of age, has been convicted of Nazi war crimes in Berlin. An old woman who worked as a Nazi concentration camp secretary has been convicted on Tuesday this week for her role in the murder of thousands of people in what could be one of the country's last trials for World War II crimes. A district court in the northern town of Izet Ho Probably pronounced that wrong. It's a hole. I'll try and put my German accent on, but it doesn't make it much better, does it? Handed Imgard Furnicher a 2-year suspended sentence for aiding and abetting the murder of 10,500 people and the attempted murder of 5 people, a court spokesperson said. But really, I mean, it's not just low-hanging fruit. It's fallen to the ground, and this is pathetic.
Well, she was a teenage secretary, and therefore she typed up all of the letters where they were discussing killing people. I mean, anybody who does anything has got to recognise that you may ultimately be held responsible for it. But you've got Zelensky in the US Congress this week comparing what's happening to Hitler's invasion of Poland, and everybody's got to get behind Ukraine, which in Russia is regarded with absolute revulsion, because, of course, the far right in Ukraine were Nazis. They were.
The point is...
They still have a Nazi ideology.
Yeah, the point is...
Loads of streets in the Ukraine have been named after Stepan Bandera.
Yeah.
He's regarded as a hero.
Extremely good point.
Ukraine, but he was a Nazi.
And also, of course, with Martin Bormann, the British bringing him over and giving him the red carpet treatment.
Well, that's right. But Martin Bormann was a gangster supreme. And he wasn't... You pointed out that he put loads of Jewish people on the boards of the companies. And, of course, a lot of the industrialists in Germany knew what was going on. The German Wirtschaftswunder, the economic miracle in the 50s and 60s, was the bringing back of the money that had been squirreled away elsewhere back into Germany to rebuild it. And, of course, everybody knew where that money had come from.
There's been a lot of criticism of the European Union this week, particularly Eva Kaili, who's a Greek MEP, and she was, until last week, the vice president or vice chair of the group of members of the European Parliament. So let's have a listen to a report this week about her arrest and continued arrest.
A Greek MEP caught up in a corruption scandal at the European Parliament has been told by a Belgian judge that she will remain in custody for another month while police continue their investigations. Eva Kaili protested her innocence and offered to wear an electronic bracelet to track her movements. She's been accused of accepting money from Qatar in return for providing political support to the country and has been stripped of her role as vice president of the European Parliament. Qatar denies wrongdoing.
So that's just a little news report from this week from the BBC, Martin, I think yesterday, actually. I look at this and I think, well, you're going for the MEPs. The real criminality in the European system is amongst the Commission, and you're not going to touch them with a barge pole.
Well, there's corruption going on in virtually every institution you can think of.
I think the Commission, surely far more, though, since the Commission is very, very close to these.
The banks are corrupt. Never mind the European Commission. In fact, is a relatively small fry in a much bigger pond.
But they have the power. They have all the power to create the new laws, etc.
All right. Well, she has been fingered for taking bribes from Qatar. But there's a very good article by Martin Jay on Strategic Culture Foundation website this week, which points out that most of the real corruption that she was involved with involved Morocco. Yeah, which is a pro-Western state.
Well, my point I'm trying to make is that the MEPs are about the only part of the European EU system who have got some reasonable amounts of honesty. There's a whole section above them.
Therefore, they have to be voted.
Well, but the people have much more power of the Commission, and they are not being called to account at all. There's no question of arresting them for anything. They are much, much closer to these big lobbying corporations even than the MEPs are. In fact, they spend some of their time just literally cutting and pasting projects from these big corporations and putting an EU logo on it.
Yes, that there is all sorts of, as I say, all sorts of corruption goes on. The EU is a notoriously corrupt organisation, but then so is the City of London and the British government.
Possibly just as much, or if not more, and the US.
A friend of mine, Laszlo Andor, I wrote a book with him, which came out in 1998, Market Failure, Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle. At that time, he was just an academic, but eventually he became a European Commissioner for Hungary, and his remit was jobs and growth. Now, I don't think he's now working with the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. He is basically a lefty like myself, and he was a European Commissioner because at that stage, Hungary was ruled by the Socialist Party, which was the Reformed Communist Party. The EU, like the World Health Organization, like all of these institutions, are sites of struggle. There's a good article by Yanis Varoufakis this week about the dangers of peace in the Ukraine, because if there is peace in the Ukraine, then the European Union is going to break into factions.
You say it's a struggle.
Because they can't agree who's going to pay to rebuild the Ukraine.
Martin, you say it's a struggle, but it seems to me that struggle's already lost. And there's actually you're just banging your head against a brick wall. It's not just me saying that. I mean, I was quite friendly and close to Grattan Healy, who was a researcher for one of the Irish Green MEPs, and he gave up. He said, look, this machine was designed to never work, and I've had enough of it, and I'm off. Don't you agree that the United States of Europe is never going to work?
European-wide coordination between progressive movements, if we're going to...
Outside the EU. It's not going to happen in there, is it?
I don't think anybody's... There may be a disorderly breakup of the EU because they can't agree about the crisis in the Ukraine. I mean, people in Portugal, where the Bilderberg are going to meet, they've got quite a decent left-wing government in Portugal. They don't want to spend money on the Ukraine. It's a long way away from them. They don't care about it. And similarly, people in Germany don't want to spend money on things in France and vice versa.
Maybe they get their comeuppance by trying to stick a square peg in a round hole.
But, I mean, what's going to happen is a disorderly breakup of the EU as they squabble amongst themselves about who's going to pay for what. But at the same time, that won't be pleasant for the people who live in Europe. A disorderly breakup of the EU is a bit like a disorderly breakup of the USSR. It'll be catastrophic for ordinary people. Varoufakis is very clear. The EU is a totally as currently constituted is basically a machine run by the Americans. Basically,
yeah. Well, I agree.
That's what it's always been. But of course, that doesn't mean that you can opt out of the European Union and then you're out of the mess.
Well, look,
it's outside the European Union now. But if there is a crash in Germany, that will cause a crash in Britain, whether we're in or out of the European Union, because everything's related
to everything. Well, it's dominoes, isn't it? It's dominoes. Look, one of the great moves by the Lords of Chaos this week has been the gender recognition certificates being passed into law up in Scotland, where young kids can have them, etc. There is a report. I don't know, are you on top of this one, Martin? I've got a report here.
I've read about it, yeah.
Right, good. So we don't need to hear the report. There's also been a similar law passed in Spain as well this week. The idea really is that you don't need any kind of doctor to get involved. And at quite a young age, you can just say, well, I'm not that sex, I'm another sex. And you could decide your own sex now in Scotland.
Yes, and it's been very controversial. And opinion polls suggest that up to 2/3 of Scots don't necessarily agree with this. And opposition to it isn't just from the reactionary right, it's very much coming from mainstream feminists. We've discussed this issue quite a lot on the show.
But it's a confusing situation, isn't it, to have what you're going to get is going to get a load of people from England who fancy being the opposite sex just go up to Scotland to get their certificate.
Well, what may happen is for example, in prisons, you might have Scottish prisoners in English prisons saying that they want to identify as women and they've got to be transferred to women's prison and so on. There's another issue, of course, which is the constitutional issue. The Scottish government has passed this law, and the suggestion that the British government, the national government, will step in and block it. Of all the things to go to the barricades for in Scotland, I find it's not really, it does, I'll be honest with you, I don't think people should just be able to decide their own gender by deciding. I think we have, for many, it's just a fact that some people are genuinely hermaphrodite. They are born that way, but it's very, very rare, very rare. And I think I've got no problem with people wanting to identify as trans or wanting to identify as a woman. I haven't got a problem with that at all. But you can't, on a legal basis, say that as a woman, I'm entitled, for example, to come into a woman's only space, which still exists and always existed. And you can see why this is going to be controversial. But what's actually happening in the wider picture is you've got this campaign for, more and more minority opinions to be accepted as about things like this, And you've got an equally boneheaded campaign from reactionaries who don't like the idea of feminism, never mind transgenderism.
Well, I don't know about that. I think much of, hang on a minute, because much of the campaigning has been from women, hasn't it? I mean, we've had Stella on our program here, saying that we're just not going to accept men just coming along and saying, well, I'm a woman now, and wandering into these women's spaces.
I have a great deal of sympathy with that. But on the other hand, I think a lot of this is... We are wasting time talking about the woke agenda.
Well, I can't quite understand why.
Yeah, but the world is on the brink.
I totally agree. But you know what doesn't seem to have got through to the Scots is stories like a transgender pervert who was arrested 15 months after she exposed herself to women and girls at the Y Spa in Los Angeles. It's triggered violent protests from the Antifa, who branded allegations a bigoted hoax. Well, now she's been finally arrested. Darren Aji Maraga, 53, was accused of indecent exposure at an LA spa. Back in June, a group of women complained that Maraga, 53, who identifies as female, exposed her penis at the Y Spa in Los Angeles to them last Tuesday, more than a year after going on the 1 a.m. In September 2021. Can't quite say on the I Am, whatever that is. Maraga was booked by police for the spa and another incident, and bail set at $350,000. A transgender person wanting for exposing their naked half erect penis to women in two separate changing room incidents in Los Angeles has been arrested after more than 15 months on the run. The suspect had been charged with five felony counts of indecent exposure, including an infamous altercation at Y Spa, where Maraga exposed herself to several women, including an underage girl. She's a convicted sex criminal and identifies as a woman, previously rebuffed the allegations, claiming to be a victim of transphobia. And then there was a demonstration in her support. And now, she's been been arrested.
Well, that is clearly unacceptable behaviour, illegal behaviour, and I would not suggest that all trans people do stuff like that. In fact, many of them do not. But if you do, then you've got to expect...
Can you imagine the situation that Scotland has now opened up here, is that women who are going to safe spaces, even places that they have to get away from a violent partner or something, might find themselves faced with a man pretending to be a woman. For example, people being treated in hospital, suddenly there's a transgender nurse, and this is not necessarily going to be the best thing to help you with your recovery, and people are just going to not be able to deal with this situation.
I've got no problem with people wanting to call themselves whatever and dress in any way they like. What you can't do on a legal basis is just say, I can decide my own gender just because I can decide it.
Well, that's the case in Scotland now.
Well, I know. I think this is a mistake. But, of course, it does raise the issue of, does the English government have the right to override the Scottish government? Because this is actually one of the things which is derogated to Scotland's side.
It seems to me the Scots are doing this just to provoke the Brits.
The Scots are Brits, Tony, if you're a unionist.
Well, all right, the English, you know what I mean.
Come on.
It's a political move. I think it's a political move rather than being done out of principle. But anyway, we shall see.
I think it's just a mistake. If you're going to go to the barricade,
that's
they should
a big
go
mistake,
to the barricade about not being given a referendum. That is the Westminster interfering in their affairs.
Okay.
People were elected to the Scottish Parliament on the understanding the Greens and the SNP said, if we win this election, we will push for a referendum. They won the election.
Okay, well, after the break, we'll be looking at the death of Hilda Morell. She was a campaigner against Sizewell B, the murder of Hilda Morell, as well as the Three Kings.
I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by the Holy Ghost, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. The third day he rose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven, and sitteth on the right hand of God the Father Almighty.
disciples, I stand before you in the name of the one true God.
So, the Porta de Lus male voice choir, Comrades in Arms, recorded back in 2008. And before that, it was the Corrected Creed. And you got a little tiny taste of Prudens Futuri in the name of the One, which is, I think, pretty shocking piece of music about the Antichrist, which I remember hearing back in the 1990s on the John Peel show. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Thank you for switching off the psycho in the corner once more to listen to us on the new talkradio.org.uk stream. Oh, it's not that new, of course, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, as well as at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And me, Tony Gosling. And we're going to start part two with a couple of poems that people have sent in this week. It's very kind. Read a couple out last week. We'll start with one called Tools for the Job. Isn't it strange how queens and kings and clowns that caper in sawdust rings and ordinary folk like you and me are building for eternity? Each are given a bag of tools, a heap of stones, a book of rules, and all must build until life has flown, a stumbling block or a stepping stone. This is from Peter Beardsley. He says when his father died, he found a little book that belonged to his father in it with some poems. And he says, not by Peter Beardsley, but most probably by his father. And also from now from Ken Lammy up in Moray in Scotland, the Dragons. London rumbles beneath my feet into the souls, Threadneedle Street, Cheapside down to St. Paul's Dome, model for capital based on Rome. Holborn, near the Gray's Inn Road, Aldgate, Moorgate, past I strode, Fleet Street there at Temple Bar, enter City, where the Dragons all are. Perhaps someday it will be fenced off and people could buy tickets and file past the dragons to learn about a warning from history, he says. Thanks very much to Ken Lammy. Merry Christmas to Tony, Martin and Dave from Ken Lammy in Moray up in Scotland. Thanks very much for those poems. Always good. You know, I think maybe, you know, if you feel like inspired, do feel free to send one in. We started off really, I suppose, with a few poems from Ian Jenkins over in Merthyr Tydfil, who's prolific on with his poems on Facebook. And he very kindly, in the space of about 15 minutes, did me a poem last week on Christmas. They're allowing us Christmas this year, it was called. So anyway, let's get stuck in to Martin, let's just look at some of the main stories in the world right now. I don't know if there's anything you'd like to point out, but we've got a new government, Netanyahu in Israel, putting together what he's saying is what many people are saying is the most far right Israeli government ever, coalition being formed now.
Well, yes, and that bodes nothing well, does it? I think more Palestinians have been killed this year by the Israeli state than in many previous years. And the whole conflict there, I mean, what happens with these things is that the latest conflict, Ukraine or whatever it is, takes over from the previous. You know, it's only when it's in the top of the news that people remember it's happening. People have forgotten all about the war in Yemen, for example, the worst humanitarian disaster in the world, which Britain could easily do something about because we're supporting the Saudis.
Yeah, and we see the former BBC correspondent Martin Bell on almost every channel where there's adverts are allowed, and probably some where there aren't, doing an appeal for Ukraine.
That's right. So everybody thinks that that's the important thing. Kate Bush wants peace in Ukraine. What about peace in Yemen, Kate? Never heard of it.
Well, I don't think the thing is that none of our side, that is the NATO and the Zelensky side, allegedly, none of them want peace because they won't negotiate.
Well, that's the upshot of Zelensky's visit to. I mean, I was reading this morning in the New York Post and the Washington Post, I think it was, they were going on about Zelensky's brave and courageous trip to the United States. It's like, why is it brave and courageous to get in a car, drive to Poland and fly in a military
it's possibly braver and more courageous to play the piano with your penis, which is what he did on TV.
Yes, I know, but that's what's the history is going to say about Zelensky is that he did negotiate when he won the election originally, promising not to do what Poroshenko wanted to do, which is retake the breakaway republics. He said, well, we want to be a normal country. We want to join the EU, boring old EU. We just want to join the boring old EU. And we want to make peace with the Russians. And that's why he won the election. But then he was threatened, the right wing threatened that if you try and make peace with the Russians, we're going to kill you. He then went to the Americans and the British and said, I want to try and make peace with the Russians. But they threatened. And they said, oh, you mustn't make peace with the Russians. Anyway, when the crisis began in February, for the very first time, the Russians and the Ukrainians started negotiating for the first time since 2015.
Okay, look, can I just drag you back to Israel, though? He says, I got it. The incoming premier tweeted on Wednesday evening, minutes before a midnight deadline set by President Isaac Herzog to form a new government following elections on the 1st of November. Thanks to the enormous public support we received in the last elections, I was able to establish a government that will work for the benefit of all Israeli citizens, he added, accompanied by a video of him calling the president. Herzog's office confirmed Netanyahu's statement had been received. But this is being talked about. It's funny the way the BBC reported it, because they said it's Israel's most right-wing government. But they didn't say anything more. In this article on Middle Eastern Eye, they say it's the most right-wing government in history.
It's the most right-wing government they've ever had. Without openly anti-Arab racists in positions of authority. And they want a war with Iran, folks.
Yeah, Itmar Ben-Gvir.
You thought the Ukraine was a problem. There's going to be a war with Iran.
So we've got
do pay attention at the back.
Bezalel Schmott Trick. leader of the Religious Zionism Political Alliance, and Imar Ben-Gvir, leader of Israel's Jewish Power Party, will take up prominent positions in the incoming government. Smotrich is a self-declared homophobe and settler activist. He's been named finance minister, will also be placed within Israel's defence ministry with oversight of settlements inside the illegally occupied West Bank. The post gives Smotrich authority over building permits in settlements, demolitions of Palestinian homes and land issues. He will also oversee two military units in charge of running civilian and security affairs in the occupied West Bank. So not just potential war with Iran, it's this is upping the ante against the Palestinians too, which is possibly more worrying.
Well, obviously from the Palestinian point of view, yes, this is all linked. It may well be that the Syrians are going to wade in. They've made it clear that they intend to take back the Golan Heights, which do not belong to Israel. And they've got backing from the Russians for that. And, of course, there's possibly going to be an invasion of Lebanon, in which case Hezbollah will fire loads and loads of missiles into Israel. And at that point, NATO will decide to support the Israelis, no doubt. That's us, folks.
Well,
we're going to war with the Russians, with the Palestinians, with the Iranians, with the Chinese. Don't forget, we've got the Chinese, they're a big threat. And global Britain will be there.
I shouldn't laugh, but you're absolutely right. It is almost comical, the ridiculousness of all this. But anyway, look as most programmes, kind of leave it there, but not tonight. Here I'm looking at the origins of the Zionists, and obviously that is the Brits have got a very big responsibility for that, haven't they, Martin?
Well, they have. The Balfour Declaration basically gave to the Zionists, who were a tiny minority of the Jews. I mean, the only Jew in the cabinet, British cabinet at the time, Montagu, I think his name was, opposed the creation of the State of Israel because he said it's just, this is a nonsense.
And who best to talk to about the origins of Zionism than Anton Chaikin, whose father, Jacob Chaikin, was the chief lawyer and strategist for the Jewish boycott in the United States of Nazi Germany. So let's have a listen to Anton talking about the Zionist origins, and particularly this chap called Sir Charles Warren, this Freemason guy. And I was just looking him up thinking, gosh, he's the same guy who was the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police during the time of those murders, Jack the Ripper murders, back in the 19th century.
First one who proposed that the Jews need to go back to Palestine was Lord Palmerston, the British foreign minister and later prime minister. In 1840, he sent a letter to the British ambassador in Turkey. Palestine at that time was part of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. And Lord Palmerston said, the Jews as a nation desire to return to Palestine. And of course, as Alba Ibn pointed out, the Jews didn't know anything about that at the time. The British then sent troops a month later for the first time and landed them in Palestine. They didn't take it over at that time, but they started to get involved. Now, after the Civil War, the British set up a very strange organization called the Palestine Exploration Fund. It was set up by Queen Victoria and by the United Grand Lodge of Masons and other people supporting Masonic ideas. What did they do? They went to Palestine, which didn't belong to Britain, it's part of the Turkish Empire, and they started to dig in the city of Jerusalem, dig for ancient temples, dig for any ruins that might be put to a certain use by the British Empire. You know, the Masons talk about restoring the Temple of Solomon, and this is what Meir Kahane and some of these crackpots of the extreme wing in Israel talk about. We got to restore the Temple of Solomon. And then your so-called fundamentalists over here will say, yes, once that's restored, then we can have our end of the world. Right? End times. Oh boy. Why did they want to restore Solomon's temple? That wasn't the last temple. There were three temples. The last time it got closed down was the third temple, not Solomon. Solomon's was the second. Why do they want to restore Solomon's temple? Because I think it might have to do with the fact that Solomon had more than God in his temple. He also had a few pagan gods in there, right? Read about that. Whatever it is, these guys from Britain went over there in the 1860s, 1870s, and dug way down. The leader of this, the head of the Palestine Exploration Fund, was a man named Sir Charles Warren, who wrote a book about his experience as the lead. He was an engineer in Her Majesty's Army. Wrote a book called Underground Jerusalem. Another book called The Temple or the Tomb. And he published a book in the 1870s proposing the colonization of that section of the Ottoman Empire that the British called Palestine in exchange for taking over Turkey's national debt. Right? And he said, let this be done with the avowed intention of gradually introducing the Jew, pure and simple, who is eventually to occupy and govern this country. It is written over and over again in the Word of God, Israel are to return to their own land. It's a British Army guy saying this, right? Okay, so now, who is this fellow? This is Charles Warren. He goes back to England. He takes a few trips to South Africa, spends a number of years killing the natives down there and shooting some of the Dutch people. And then he goes back in 1886 to London, and he starts a new Masonic organization, and it's called the Quatuor Coronati Lodge. Now let's write this down for you specialists in the audience. Quatuor Coronati means the four crowned ones. This is a research lodge of the Freemasons, the British Freemasons. By the way, when I say Freemason, I mean British Freemasons, because as of this point in time in the world today, there's nothing but British Freemasonry. On the whole planet, with a minor exception in France, don't say Freemasonry, say British Freemasonry, okay? It's British. Anyway, this is a special lodge they set up. This guy was the head of it. He had another job at the same time. He was police commissioner in London. And it just happened at that time that the royal family had a little problem. The grandson of the queen married the wrong person, see? And they wanted to cover that up, and she was hustled off to an insane asylum, and all the witnesses were killed, cut up with Masonic signs all over them. And they said, oh, it's a lone assassin named Jack the Ripper. It was nice to have a police commissioner who's also the head of this lodge, Quatuor Coronati. Also, they had the assistant coroner who's in the same little group. And he lost his job because there was a big uproar about that, but so what? He helped the royal family out, you know. This lodge went on to do very interesting things. They produced some new groups in the world. One group that they controlled was called the Theosophists. Another group that they controlled was called Astrology. Astrology had been ended in Europe possibly hundreds of years before. There was some little bits of astrology that would float through France, etc., etc., but at least for 100 years, or much more than that, it was dead in France and Germany. And in the 1890s, the British reintroduced it into Germany and France. Why would they do that? Geopolitics. And these guys write about how they did it and how proud they are of introducing superstition into Europe. There was a group called the Order, capital O, Order of the Golden Dawn, that was organized by this little group in England, this research lodge, who are the founders and promoters of Zionism also, right, in the sense of having actually undertaken this as a project. This group was later run by Aleister Crowley, is a pretty famous Satanist who came to Hollywood and helped start Hollywood early in this century. These guys were running Freemasonic and various occultist things in Turkey to shake things up in Turkey and prepare the way for the Messiah? I doubt it. Right? Prepare the way for British geopolitical gains and control the route to India and so forth, right? It's a very strategic area, Israel, right? Palestine, right between Europe, Asia, and Africa. So they had in Turkey all of these crazy false Muslim groups based on the Sufi tradition, run by the British. The B'nai B'rith was there in great depth, run by the British. There was a guy who went down there to Turkey from Germany and became involved with these British organizations, became a Turkish Freemason there and astrologer named Sabatendorf. I don't know if I've spelled it correctly, but he became famous later. He went back to Germany and founded another suborder of this thing called the Thule Society, which is the people who taught Adolf Hitler about the occult. All run by the British. Houston Stuart Chamberlain was there living in southern Germany and promoting, he married Wagner's daughter and was promoting Nazism for the British.
So, priceless little section there of a talk by back from the 1990s by Anton Chaitkin, talking about this guy Sir Charles Warren and this Quattro Coronati Lodge. I'm not quite sure what their lodge number is. I'm sure it's not going to be that easy, difficult to find it out. But interesting, the links to the royal family, interesting, Martin, the links to Zionism, interesting, the links to the OTO and Crowley and to the Jack the Ripper murders.
Well, I mean, the problem that you're going to find is that people, when they hear the Jack the Ripper murders, people immediately think they're crackpots coming up with this stuff about it's covering up the... I'm sure that things like this were going on. For sure. You know, the people who ran the British Empire at its height were extremely devious. People like Cecil Rhodes, very devious people. And, of course, that was always their plan to break up the Ottoman Empire and take over in Palestine and so on and so forth. You know, when the State of Israel was created, they talked about it. I think we've talked about it. We need a little Ulster in the middle of the Middle East to protect the Suez Canal. So the thinking was that if we can have a Jewish state in Israel, that can be a buffer for us to keep the Suez Canal open so that we can carry on exploiting India. And they saw the British Empire as the fulfillment of God's will on earth. It seems absurd now to think like this, but they did think
well,
like this.
Well, I mean, you mentioned Webster Tarpley earlier, didn't you? I'm not sure what context, but... He co-authored a book called George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, with Anton Chaitkin. This is George Bush Sr., The Unauthorized Biography, yep. Which was, wasn't it kind of an underground bestseller or something? Because these two put together a lot of historical information. Anton has now got a book, another book out. He's still going strong. America, it's called Who We Are, America's Fight for Universal Progress from Franklin to Kennedy. And he's, the first volume's out anyway, it was 1750s to the 1850s. So, he's just a terrific guy, terrific writer and proper. Thing is, you know, he's got kind of, he's the sort of receptacle for the knowledge of learned Jews right across the Western world who were fighting Hitler and realised just how pernicious the Zionists were in breaking the boycott against Nazi Germany, etc. He says for this new book, Who We Are, half a century ago, the Anglo-American establishment reversed the politics that made America rich, powerful and humane. They erased our former way of thinking from public memory. They took away from us our original national mission, gaining a scientific control over nature to uplift mankind. And they falsely inserted their own goal, power for the few over the many, into our history so that no remedy from our real heritage seemed possible. He's also very much blaming the Brits for this. He's saying the British turned the French Revolution to anarchy and mass bloodshed. The first documented account of that regime change intervention. So he's saying he's blaming the British partly for the French Revolution. America's founding program is blocked until a new generation of nationalist leaders fight the British again and start industrialization. So he's blaming the Brits for most of this, Martin.
Well, I think that's too simple. The British Empire and the networks of power surrounding it have been very pernicious. over the decades and centuries. But it isn't the British people that have done this.
Well, it's no, these, I don't, he's not exactly. saying that. No, he's not saying that.
Well, really. Exactly. So, I mean, when you start saying the British, the Americans, the Jews, you know, even the Zionists, because there is a spectrum of opinions within Zionism. Although what I think that the liberal Zionists, the pro-peace Zionists, have been buried by this recent election in Israel. They've been
outmanoevered.
It's becoming fascist.
Just as the Americans have been outmaneuvered and the British have been outmaneuvered. Anyway, I thought it'd be a good also because of we've been discussing energy, we've been discussing Extinction Rebellion, these sorts of things, and the green move towards nuclear power, particularly the announcement of the go-ahead for Sizewell C over in Suffolk. We've had all our problems for a decade or more now with Hinkley C and these new power stations that may or may not actually work when they get finally built. $20 billion or so, or $30 billion each, they're going to cost, or they are costing. Much of that money may just go to the people that built them, and then they will never work at the end of the day. But anyway, David Halpin, it was, that reminded me about the death of Hilda Morell. She died in 1984. She was a campaigner against nuclear power. She was saying particularly that the inability to deal with the waste and things like clusters of leukemias around nuclear power stations meant that you should never be building these things. And so she was involved in the public inquiry into the construction of Sizewell B. Anyway, let's have a listen now to David Halpin, the doctor, retired surgeon on Hilda Morell.
We're talking about Hilda Morell, who was born around 1908, I think, and who inherited a wonderful rose nursery and nurse and rose breeding setup from her father, but she was always interested in the environment. But when she retired, when the nursery was sold on, she then focused on the widest environmental concern. She loved the natural world, and she was obviously a woman of the highest intellect and morality. She was a remarkable lady, and she was preparing. She'd already had made her position very clear, and she was preparing to speak at a public inquiry about Sizewell B on the Suffolk coast. She was found in a car off a small road, murdered. And the book, there are several books about her, but I got to know Rob Green. He'd been a commander in the RN, Naval Intelligence, and he was involved in Falklands War, I can recall. He later retired from the Navy, became a Thatcher. Not a Thatcherite, a Thatcher. And he wrote a book about Hilda's death called A Thorn in the Side, a good pun. And I got to know Rob. I don't know how it was, but he stayed with his wife or partner, Kate Dewes, Dewes, in our house here. Some years ago, I got to know him well, and we discussed what the motive was for her killing. There's no doubt that her murder, the investigation was covered up in some way, and a man called David George, I think, was nailed eventually for her murder. Andrew George, sorry. There's some story, some implication about rape as well, and about her house being burgled. But I know that the body had multiple stab wounds. And there's no doubt, there's critical evidence, especially from the farmer on whose land, or I think the land where she was found, there was an entry to his field past the car, her car where the body was found. And he said that he would have found the corpse before the 5 days which it took the police to find it, because he was there, I think. Implication was he was there every day, presumably to feed stock. So that's one of the essential faults in the whole story. The late discovery of the body investigation. I can't remember it all actually now, but Rob Green's book is good and should be read. I can't find it on our shelves. I must have lent it to someone. It hasn't come back.
So there is a bizarre, I mean, this is an elderly retired lady, that this would be a sexual assault is a bit of a surprise.
It is. Now, I can't remember the details about that, but it's very morbid. We'll leave that aside. The central fact is that she was murdered. There was a delay in her body being found. And there's no question that the investigation of it and the conclusions of our so-called justice system was at fault. And I know that Rob Green has continued thinking and speaking. We didn't share the same thoughts about the motivation for her murder, but I know that since he moved over to New Zealand to be with Kate, who is a New Zealander, and who was a very vigorous and very effective campaigner against nuclear power and especially against nuclear weapons in New Zealand, that since he's been over there, he's had burglaries and various other means of oppression to shut him up, to be quite blunt about it.
That's David Halpin there, talking about the death of Hilda Morell. And he goes on to talk about what he thinks is the enormous power of the nuclear industry.
The nuclear power industry is massively powerful. And behind it is what we'll come on to, what I call the Armageddonists. Their love of nuclear power and nuclear explosions. I mean that. There is the need for energy. We know that the idea that nuclear power can be the main source of energy, unnecessary energy, is a nonsense, a very expensive nonsense, seen best at Hinkley Point. But I go back to Windscale. Now, I haven't looked up the Wikipedia account of that, but it was a good one. And that Windscale fire of the atomic pile there, and I forget the year, it was well, long time ago. The name was changed significantly to Sellafield afterwards, typical British trick. But the account of that fire was a very important matter. The two seniors who were in charge of the of that facility when it caught fire, their evidence was very important. They were apparently cutting corners. Listen to that, Tony. They were cutting corners to produce plutonium for our American friends, inverted commas friends. That's why it happened. They were cutting corners. And when the isotopes went up that tall chimney, the so-called plume, spread over the southeast, towards the southeast, over our country, and over Europe. They gave iodine tablets to children in the immediate area. Don't know how wide, I can't remember. That was to block the uptake of the young thyroids from iodine I-131. It is incidental, but possibly connected, that my sister Mary, who's near death, had a papillary cancer of the thyroid, negligently presented by her GP too late, but she had an operation for that 8 years ago. But she might have been one of the victims of the I-131 poisoning of populations. I know a good deal about that. But we're dealing with elemental evil. We're dealing with the production of the most terrible elements found by physicists, people like Marie Curie originally.
So that's David Halpin just summarising his thoughts about, firstly, on the actual death of Hilda and his contacts with Robert Green, author of A Thorn in Their Side, The Hilda Morell Murder, which was published, got a copy in my hands here, by Robert Green in 2011. This is... I suppose 40 years after her death in 1984, roughly. So just looking at this, I mean, it's an absolutely amazing book, terrific book, as you'd expect from someone who's worked in military intelligence who wants to tell the public what happened to Hilda. Quite clearly, she was assassinated. The question is, I suppose, much more who by. It certainly wasn't just by this guy who's doing time for her murder. He has a brilliant summary at the end, which is far too long to read out, about the points he still has not answered. And I'll just read the first few. So he says, I will now summarise my main outstanding concerns and unanswered questions about Hilda's case. There are nearly 50 of them, so don't worry, I won't go through them all. But Gerard Morgan Grenville, evidence. He's a ex-military officer who was responsible for the building of the Centre for Alternative Technology, for example. His evidence that Hilda, uncharacteristically agitated, ended a half-hour phone call with him shortly before she was abducted and killed with the words, if they don't get me first, I want the world to know that at least one old woman has seen through their lies. Tam Dl MP, as never wavered in his allegation that British intelligence were involved. It was corroborated by Judith Cook's separate source and by BBC journalist Patrick Burns. Also, from my experience, he says, as a naval intelligence officer with top security clearance, MI5 would have discovered I knew there were things to hide over the Falklands War, which were potentially more serious than the torpedoing of General Belgrano. So various, just one more we'll have. Hilda was in correspondence with Ross Hethgith, a senior safety scientist at the Central Electricity Generating Board, who'd just been sacked for revealing that plutonium from British reactors was being secretly supplied to the Americans for nuclear weapons. So that's just three or four of 50 points in this terrific, I mean, it's the book, really, on the Hilda Morell murder by Robert Greene, A Thorn in Their Side, Martin.
Yes, those were the days when we had a central electricity generating board owned by the government. Gosh, only 40 years ago. Well, these stories are the tip of the iceberg of what the deep state's been up to over the years. Clearly, we only know a fraction of what's really happened.
Anyway, so we're going to hear now, finally, on this topic from Robert Greene himself. He did at the launch of this book, and also at the 50th anniversary of her murder, which I suppose would have been, it's the 40th anniversary back in 2013 or maybe 28. Anyway, it was recently, fairly recently. Here's Robert Greene himself.
And one of my great inspirations, Dan Ellsberg, who went through a similar process to myself. Anyway, I won't go on much longer, but I just want to tell you the particular reason that I'm standing here is a story that I have written in this book, and I'm sorry if this looks like a bit of a crude commercial, but it's actually the reason I'm in this country at the moment. I have an aunt called Hilda Morell, who some of you may have heard of. It's a long time ago. It's 28 years. And it just shows how long these things take. But I finally got around to writing the story about her murder. And she was an anti-nuclear energy campaigner in 1984, and she was also anti-nuclear weapons. She inspired me to come out against nuclear energy, and then eventually nuclear weapons. But it was very tough. It took a long time. One of the reasons that I did it was because I learned that basically she had been assassinated. It's not really a murder case. This is a case of assassination. And it's very bad, very complicated. It's been heavily covered up, and I've now nearly got to the truth. But I'm over here to make sure that this book, which has had to be printed in great secrecy, even in New Zealand, because of the power of the British state to try to stop the truth coming out. And I can tell you that I have good reason to believe that my aunt was, in fact, taken out by the British state. And I'm now being harassed by the British state, even in New Zealand, for daring to write this book and to try and get some truth and try to stop it happening again, because I'm afraid I'm shortly going to be going down to visit Dr. David Halpern, who is a pathologist who is championing the David Kelly case. Now, there's another guy, I warn you, that he's another case. And unless we actually stand up and pursue this and work together on these problems, they're going to do it again and again with impunity under this mask that this is the mother of democracies. And they do it in the States all the time. And it's a lie. And one of the problems is that, at least in a totalitarian state, you know where you stand. That these thugs are there. But here, they pretend that they play cricket. And they don't, I'm afraid. So we've got to stand up. And the good news is that Michael Mansfield QC is coming behind this case now. And we're hoping we're going to get parliamentary pressure in the next couple of months. And we're going to get a reopening of the case. There's a guy in jail who was framed, a 16-year-old boy at the time, truant from a foster home, enticed into the appalling operation that went on to abduct and then interrogate my aunt, what she might have known about the Falklands and about nuclear energy and weapons, and then she had to be disposed of. And I just want to say one final personal thing, is that one of the reasons that I believe she was taken out was because I was an intelligence officer in the Northwood bunker, and it was to do with the sinking of the Argentine cruiser, the General Belgrano, which severely, well, there was a campaign by a maverick politician called Tam Deal, he's still alive, because he was being fed some very good information to show that, in fact, that ship should not have been torpedoed in cold blood because it was not actually inside the exclusion zone. And Mrs. Thatcher badly needed a full-blooded war because her political career was on the rocks. And the Navy saved her political skin, and then she got embarrassed because she had allowed, in fact, probably ordered that ship to be sunk deliberately in order to make sure she got a war, because it looked like they were going to have a ceasefire and it was all going to be over with this skirmish. And so there are a lot of people who've got a lot of stuff to hide about that one, and it's 30 years to the day coming up in about 2 weeks' time. I will be back in New Zealand by then, but I hope there'll be a bit of a fuss about the truth about that. But I can assure you, I didn't nick any documents, but someone certainly was feeding Tam Deal, and they are trying to cover all that up. It's a very big and nasty secret. So anyway, look, thank you for listening to me rambling on. I wish you well, and keep going.
So that's the voice of ex Naval Intelligence Officer Robert Green there, Martin, the author of A Thorn in Their Side, a book about Hilda Morell.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was in my 20s when all this happened, and we were aware at the time that there was a load of, you know, a load of questions to be asked about this. And, of course, the sinking of the General Belgrano was a deliberate policy by Margaret Thatcher to make sure that she got a war, because a peace plan was being discussed. The Americans didn't want a war in between Argentina and Britain, and they, you know, they had quite a lot of influence. And the Peruvians have put forward a compromise proposal which would have led to some kind of settlement between Britain and Argentina. But Margaret Thatcher quite deliberately sabotaged that.
And all over a bunch of oil fields, Martin, all over a bunch of oil fields, which apparently we don't want anymore.
Well, at the time, it wasn't a question of oil fields because they didn't even know there was oil there. Although, of course, subsequently it turned out that there was.
Well, I don't know about that. I would imagine that they... Listen, I mean, they may well have just not told anyone that the oil was there.
All right. Well, in any case, from the Argentinian point of view, the fact that you've got 1,000 sheep herders on this island doesn't give you the right to control the continental shelf of Argentina. Because the continental shelf of Argentina has got all sorts of resources on it, which they would argue are our resources, not your resources. Just because you've got some people parked on this rock here doesn't mean you've got access to these resources. And there's an obvious solution to this, which is we keep the Falkland Islands and carry on subsidising the people who are herding sheep, and all of the oil fields and everything else go to Argentina. But that's not what's happened. British multinationals like BP have started saying that they're going to develop these oil fields in the British interest. And, of course, Argentina sees Britain as the imperialist power in Argentina, because they dominated the economy for many decades.
Well, let's just bring this up.
Of course, the populace in Argentina have always been campaigning against British control of their economy. So this is the history of all of that.
Yeah, well, they won the World Cup. Martin, they won the World Cup.
Dictatorship.
They won the World Cup.
But yes, obviously that's. But I mean, of course, what's also happened is Kirchner, who's former president, there's been some suggestion that she's corrupt. But you've got left-wing governments across Latin America, including Argentina now, and the coup in Peru, where Castillo has been driven from power and 26 odd people have been killed in protest. Most of the left-wing governments in Latin America have refused to accept that coup, and a showdown is emerging.
Yeah, that's right. It's not been covered hardly at all in the UK. If you want to follow this stuff, folks, you've got to watch Al Jazeera. All sorts of stuff about these stories on Al Jazeera, not on here.
What we will hear about is protests in Iran and the war in Ukraine.
Yes,
we
exactly.
We don't hear about Yemen. We don't want to hear about Peru, and we don't want to hear about ancient history about the Falklands War, which we won anyway.
So anyway, anywhere where the evil empire is up to no good, the story just doesn't get covered. Look, let's have a listen now. I mean, before we get on to our final thing about the three wise men, wise or otherwise, they certainly were wise enough to be at the right place at the right time. Let's just hear from Mike Harris about what is going on right now with these kind of NATO gangster empire.
The very first article I wrote for Veterans Today back in 2011 addressed the hacking of and capture by Iran of the top secret drone that the U.S. was flying over Iran. And people wondered how they can do it. Well, I'll tell you how they can do it. Whenever you trust your process, your manufacturing process, to a third party, whether they're Taiwanese or Chinese or whatever, they have control over what you build. You do not. You relinquish it when you give them the task of building your product. So what China was doing was they would build the product to the specification, but they would add additional layers of circuitry within those semiconductors so that they could hack, so they could take control of electronic systems via the devices that comprise that system, via the whether it's a microprocessor or any number of 20, 30 other devices that could be in these devices. But they have the ability by adding additional circuitry, and the device will perform well. It'll perform to spec. It'll do everything you expect it to. It just does a lot more than what the original manufacturer's design says it's going to do, and that was one of the clever things that was done. And the U.S. military is really, really vulnerable with this at this point in time.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? You're giving somebody a specification, blueprints or whatever, to build something, and they're saying, well, here it is. But actually what they've done is they've built a little backdoor into it that they haven't told you about. Well, what about listening to semiconductors? Because, I mean, it's one thing to get in there and start moving things around in terms of data. But I would imagine it's not rocket science to be actually able to listen in to what is going around on inside a semiconductor. That isn't necessarily going to be too complicated. I wonder about that.
They can measure the data and stuff. They can gather tremendous amounts of data that way. I mean, things as simple as your cell phone. I mean, you may not know it, but they can turn the camera on. They can turn the microphone on your cell phone right now, and you may be being eavesdropped on and never even know it. But back to the military and the defense stuff, essentially you have a fighter pilot in his jet, chasing another aircraft to engage it. He fires the missile, and they now have the ability to have that missile turn around and come back and blow the guy who fired it right out of the sky.
So that's Mike Harris, who used to work for Motorola in semiconductors. A fascinating interview there. Martin, he also talks about the Donald Cook incident, where the main warship in the US fleet in the Black Sea, in charge of a carrier group, was just shut down. The whole entire ship just stopped. And in fact, all of the sailors on it resigned as a result. So this whole business of being able to, I mean, it does make you think that actually NATO is just kind of saber rattling when it comes to a fight with the Russians. They'd lose. They know they would.
The Donald Cook, of course, was a spy ship like the USS Liberty, which was attacked by the Israelis in 1967.
Well, it was a guided missile cruiser or destroyer, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it had a lot of electronic warfare stuff on it. And what the Russians did is they jammed all the electronics on the ship, and then they had a bomber with empty bomb, with the bomb doors were open on the bomber, but there were no bombs in it, and they flew 16, I think it was, sorties over the ship, and there's nothing that they could do. They've got all the capacity supposedly to shoot it down, but they can't shoot it down.
My point is here that NATO actually is scared to death of any kind of war with the Russians because they know they'd lose.
Well, I think they're not as scared as they should be. That's part of the problem, because there's a lot of delusion in the leadership in the West. These people are criminal, but they're not necessarily smarter than smart as you think.
Okay, so anyway, I'll put that interview with Mike up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And the reason I got hold of him was because last time we spoke a few months ago, he was talking about a website he contributes to. He's one of the foreign editors of Veterans Today in the US, which is called theinteldrop.org. That is theinteldrop.org. And when I came to look it up live on the show to give a couple of reports from it, it had been shut down by the FBI. It's now back and over in Iceland, but certainly very well worth a look that. And so, like I say, Mike Harris, I'll put a link up to the full interview with him up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But our final item this evening, we're looking at the Magi, the journey of the Magi, the wise men. Another longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later, with the author of The Dying God, which is a look at ancient religions, ancient faiths, and also he talks really about these kind of two different versions of history, where there's the official version and then his version, or the real version of history. But he thinks that the Magi and the visit of the three wise men to the site of the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem is where it all starts. A lot of the rise of the occult through Kabbalah and this sort of thing.
This is the whole point, and this is the whole basis of occult history. So the funny thing is that they are not really discussed in mainstream history. So I'm going to read to you two paragraphs from Albert Pike's Morals and Dogma that was published, and I'm not sure, maybe in the 1850s, approximately middle of the 18th century, to show you how this occult version, this occult interpretation or understanding of the Magi is fundamental to the history of Freemasonry in particular and the occult in general. So he says, to quote, "The occult science of the ancient Magi was concealed under the shadows of the ancient mysteries. It was imperfectly revealed, or rather disfigured, by the Gnostics. It is guessed at under the obscurities that cover the pretended crimes of the Templars, and it is found enveloped in enigmas that seem impenetrable, the rites of the highest Masonry. Magism was the science of Abraham and Orpheus, of Confucius, of Zoroaster. It was the dogmas of this science that were engraven on the tables of stone by Enoch and Trismegistus. Moses purified and reveiled them, for that is the meaning of the term reveal. He covered them with a new veil. When he made the holy Kabbalah the exclusive heritage of the people of Israel and the inviolable secret of its priests. The mysteries of Thebes and Eleusis, preserved among the nations some symbols of it, already altered, and the mysterious key whereof was lost among the instruments of an ever-growing superstition. Jerusalem, the murderess of her prophets, and so often prostituted to the false gods of the Syrians and Babylonians, had at length its turn lost the holy word, when a prophet announced by the Magi, by the consecrated star of initiation, which is Sirius, came to rend asunder the worn veil of the old temple, in order to give the church a new tissue of legends and symbols that still and ever conceal from the profane and ever preserves to the elect of the same truths." So the key with the Magi is that they were a Babylonian priesthood. And so conventionally, it's understood to refer to the priests of the Persian religion of Zoroastrianism. There was also at the same time another cult priesthood that were known as Chaldeans, and this was the Babylonian priesthood. So again, there's so much focus on Greek history and so little, the birthplace of so much of this tradition, that this history escapes most people. So the Chaldean Magi, as they were called, were famous throughout the world as a sort of wise man. So there's one book which is really important, has been really important for me, which is written by Frantz Cumon. He's a Belgian scholar, and I've said this many times before that he's, in my opinion, the greatest academic, at least for ancient history, of the 20th century. And what makes him so skilled is that you get a lot of academics these days that focus really on one path of history. And what made him unique is that he was very well versed not only in Greek history, but also in Babylonian and Egyptian history. So he was able to trace the parallels that others missed. So the important key here of what Cumon demonstrated is that, first of all, you have to start with this notion that the Magi were priests of the religion of Zoroaster, or what's called Zoroastrianism. It's a Persian religion. It's well known for having two gods, Ahura Mazda and Ahriman. Sorry if I pronounced that badly. Who basically were in eternal cosmic conflict. And so what Cumon points out is that the Magi that became famous throughout the world practiced a number of doctrines and beliefs that had nothing to do with Orthodox Zoroastrianism. There's another book by R.C. Zahner as well too, about called Zurbanism, which is another book which explains this diversion. So, in fact, Zahner explains that these magi, the ones who became popular, because our word magic comes from magi, he explains that they were actually deva worshippers. So they were devas was the in Persian culture. That was the name for demons, effectively. So effectively, they were demon worshippers. They were worshippers of Ahriman, the evil god. So basically what was happening is that there was a number of books that were circulating in the ancient world that were falsely attributed to Zoroaster. Not only to him, but also his disciple and his patron. So one to Zosimus and the other one to Hystaspes. So there's no survival of these books, but there's elements of it that survived in other people's books. And that's how Cumon was able to sort of partially reconstruct what have been beliefs of the Magi. So fundamentally, what you see is that they worship some kind of dying god. In their case, it was Mithras or Mithra, which is basically the Persian version of Baal. And a version of the goddess. I think her name was Anahita, which is the origin of Athena. And they would have practiced, believed in astrology, numerology. They believed in reincarnation and vegetarianism. So now again, back to Greece. So this is where it's important is that in Greece, we already have a sort of a bedrock of this dying god tradition that was existing there through the survival of various, you know, the worship of Dionysus and various other versions. And so what happens is that in the year, I think it's 538, Cyrus conquers Babylon from the Babylonians, and he releases the Jews from captivity. What happens at this point is that the majority of them are allowed to return to Israel and to rebuild the temple. But they don't all return there. Some of them go to Egypt, and some of them end up in Greece. Because what's important here is that the Persian Empire conquered the entire area of what is today Turkey. And so on the very westernmost part of Turkey was a region called, a Greek-speaking region called Ionia. And it's well known that the first beginnings of Greek philosophy began there. And again, what historians don't tell you is that those philosophers emerge under Persian occupation.
So that's David Livingston. Much longer treatise on this whole idea of the Magi. He was really chuffed, actually, to be phoned up to ask about it, because he says this is where it all starts, the Magi, and it's a really interesting key to unlocking that hidden version of history, Martin. Well, what do you make of what he's saying there about, you know, the idea that much of history, he's saying that the Greek civilization was influenced by these originally Zoroastrians.
Well, the fact is all the civilizations have influenced all other civilizations. Once Jesus was dead and he became, a cult figure, the Bible was written, and quite a lot of things were written into the Bible about his early life to make him the Messiah. So that's why we've got the whole Christmas story and all the rest of it.
Well, not necessarily, no. I mean, you know, that's...
So,
no, well, that's, look, that's, I mean, Martin, that is your view. Yeah, that's your view. Course, and it's not a very charitable thing to be doing at Christmas, to say that the whole Christmas story was just made up and you know it was made up, because you don't.
All right, I'm just saying that if we're going to go into these thickets, this is the sort of thing we need to talk about. The Magi, Zoroastrianism still exists. There are Parsis in India who are Zoroastrians, and they're fire worshippers. They used to be quite powerful in Armenia before Armenia was Christianized. The Magi in the Bible were written into the Bible to show that Jesus was in
well,
fact...
Well, or else they were actually there. This is just your... What you're doing is you're giving an opinion and you're trying to state it as fact, which we try not to do on
this
program.
Well, you're giving an opinion and trying to state it as fact.
No, I'm not. There is another point of view on this, and that is coming from a woman called Rebecca Holt, who you'll probably disagree with, that she's just some sort of fantasist, from the Stay Brigham Young University. And she looks at the connections between the three wise men and actually them being talked about, prophesied in the Old Testament.
When Jesus was born in Bethlehem, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he that is born King of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and are come to worship him." No mention of them being kings, no mention of how many, no mention of how they traveled. But there's a lot of clues there about them. The fact that they were in the east when they saw the star, that's how I choose to read it, rather than that wherever they are, they saw the star in the east, but rather that they were in the east when they saw the star. And east of Jerusalem is where the vast majority of Jews were actually living at the time of Christ. The Jews were taken into captivity in Babylon 600 years before the birth of Christ, and they never came home. Only a small contingent returned to Jerusalem. So the center of learning for the Jews was Babylon. And that's where the wise men would be, wise men like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so they will continue to be advisors to the court and will be literate, scientific men who in Babylon would be studying astronomy for the signs of the sky and to determine when to have the holy days that are spoken of in Scripture. So if you're coming to worship the King of the Jews, odds are you're Jewish. And you're reading about him in a Jewish book, which would be the Old Testament. And Isaiah in particular has a lot to say about those who come to worship the King of the Jews. And I think that Christians asked a lot of questions as this story in Matthew was told and written down. They wanted more information. Where did they come from? What were their names? How did they get there? And so they turned back to their scriptures to find those answers. And so it's in chapter 60 of Isaiah. We get a lot of indication of where those answers came from. It begins, "Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon thee." So the light has arisen. The star is there. And in verse 3, "And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising." So immediately we say, they're Gentile kings. And then it says, "A multitude of camels will cover thee, the dromedaries." And so we have camels as the way they're coming, and in particular, dromedary camels, coming from Midian and Ephah and Sheba. Well, there you have the three countries. So there are three of them. And in particular, Ephah and Midian are Middle Eastern countries. Sheba is Ethiopia. And so one of these kings must be black. They'll end up with names from the early Christians, being named Balthazar and Caspar and Melchior. Those are just honestly made up names, but they're great. They're great names. And then it describes what these Gentile kings will bring. They will bring gold and incense and show forth the praises of the Lord. So in my mind, I think, okay, we have Jewish men who are educated and literate, and they read in the scriptures that there will be a star, that's from the book of Numbers, that will arise at his birth in the prophecies of Balaam. So looking for that star, they search the heavens, and finding a star that they believe to be that star, they say, when that star arises, we got to get camels and go. And what we need to bring is gold and incense. And so they will bring gold, which is a kingly gift. They'll bring incense, probably two different kinds, frankincense and myrrh. Frankincense was offered at the temple with every offering, both on the altar of prayer and the altar of sacrifice. Myrrh was melted down and mixed in a special recipe into the anointing oil of the temple, and was also used for anointing the bodies of the dead. So there's some great symbolism there.
Well, that I'm reliably informed by Dave, our sound engineer, is a Mormon university, Stay Brigham Young University, who were the wise men. But she's making, I think, some interesting connections between, well, I suppose you're saying, Martin, is that the New Testament writers wrote all that stuff, just made it up so that it fitted with the Old Testament.
Yes, that is what mainstream scholarship believes.
Yeah, well, we're not mainstream scholarship here by any means. So anyway, David Livingston goes on to say what he thinks we can do about the position of we find ourselves in today with this completely fake version of history foisted on us by the occultists.
To be blunt, it's a centuries-long satanic conspiracy, right? And the goal is to humiliate humanity by duping them into creating a new world order, which is effectively going to be their own prison. So humanity is being duped into building their own prison and a prison of debauchery. That's the ultimate goal and the ultimate humiliation. So the thing is, you know, like I often say, is that because, you know, occultists like to treat the truth as something that can be hidden. And they like to talk about, you know, the truth being suppressed and books being hidden, and because that's how they operate, because they operate not on wisdom, but on information. Because for them, ultimate knowledge is magic. And magic is basically just a fraud. And true wisdom, you can't take away wisdom, because wisdom is in every man's heart, man or woman's heart. But the problem is that we are living in a world where everything, there's an apparatus in place to try to get us to deceive ourselves, to betray our conscience. So we're all born knowing what's right and wrong, but we are presented with versions of reality to induce us to, again, betray ourselves. So particularly a version of history. So this is why the whole idea of Western history is a fabrication, largely to help people, Westerners in particular, but the whole world effectively, to arrive at particular conclusions, to view the world a certain way which serves this agenda. So what has to happen is that people know deep in their hearts what's right and wrong. And they know that they know what they are doing is wrong. They know that they have deceived themselves just to follow along with everybody else. And they know that what's happening around them is wrong. The problem is that they're afraid. They feel overwhelmed. They don't see how their actions could have a consequence. And that's because they don't have belief in God, because God is the true power. What they need to recognize, they need to have more trust in themselves. They need to trust themselves to affirm deep down what they know is the truth, and to stand up for it, and to believe that they are not alone, because it's not about what they can do or any group of them can do. It's entirely they can rely on God. God is the ultimate power, no matter what these Luciferian, what kind of power these Luciferians accumulate, it will never be not even a speck compared to the enormous power that God can wield. And that's ultimately what this purpose is. We're here effectively to discover just that, to recognize that, you know, what we need to do is we need to discover the truth. So people need to read, they need to study, they need to understand what's going on, and they need to share that information to wake up other people. We need a critical mass of people. We need a number large enough to be able to oppose the agenda. And, you know, we can never be afraid of how much power they've accumulated. We have to recognize that God is waiting for us to recognize that we can only do it through him.
So more courage, less fear, more faith.
Yes.
Okay, David Livingston, can you just remind us where people can go and find your latest book online? And can we get a paperback copy or hardback copy of it?
You bet. Thank you, Tony. So my website is ordoabcowell.ca. That's where you'll find online. So my six volumes, you'll see there's a menu at the top, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. For each from there, you see all the chapters of each of the volumes. So you can read the book online or from the homepage. For a menu page, you'll see there's links to buy my book on Amazon. So that's a paperback version or a Kindle version.
So that's plugging his book there, Ordo Ab Cao, which is the motto of the Scottish Rite of Freemasons. David Livingston summing up, you know, basically, Martin, they're being bamboozled. And he talks there about a new world order. That's what they want to impose, a kind of prison on humanity.
Well, I'm familiar with this kind of thinking, but it's not really capable of being argued with, is it? If you make bold statements like he does, which rely on faith.
It's not a bold statement. He's done about five books now, explaining why he thinks what he thinks.
But and he's got an opinion about what history's about. As far as he's concerned, there's a struggle between Luciferianism and no doubt his version of Christianity.
He's a Muslim.
All right, well, he's a Muslim. And of course, Muslims don't believe that Jesus was resurrected. They believe he was a prophet, but that he wasn't resurrected. And they don't see him in that light at all. So, there's different eschatology for Muslims and for Christians, and there's different versions of Muslim and Christian beliefs.
Yeah, anyway, so that's David Livingston's version.
There's all sorts of bric-a-brac out there, and we've all got it.
Well, David's also done the best book, in my opinion, in the world on transhumanism, and he's identified it as the kind of the new fascism. Anyway, I hope you're going to stay with us, Martin, because we're going to hear now, finally, from Archbishop Vignaglio, on the World Economic Forum, and he's a Catholic Archbishop still. I don't think he's been sacked quite from the Vatican yet. Talking about
where is he based? I'm thinking, is he based in Italy?
We can tell you afterwards. But he's been quite prolific criticising the various governments, a bit like Andrew Bridgen, really, on their COVID policy. But now, particularly focused on criticising the World Economic Forum and their attempt to, sort of privatise the United Nations and individual governments.
Just in the past few days, at the G20 summit, Klaus Schwab instructed heads of government, almost all coming from the Young Global Leader from Tomorrow program of the World Economic Forum, about the future steps to be taken in view of establishing a world government. The president of a very powerful private organization with enormous economic means exercises undue power over world government, obtaining their obedience from political leaders who have no popular mandate to subject their nations to the delusion of power of the elite. This fact is of unprecedented gravity. Klaus Schwab said, I quote, "In the fourth industrial revolution, the winners will take it all. So if you are a World Economic Forum first mover, you are the winners, end quote. These very serious statements have two implications. The first is that the winners will take it all and will be winners. It is not clear in what capacity or with whose permission. The second is that those who do not adapt to this fourth industrial revolution will find themselves ousted and will lose. They will lose everything, including their freedom. In short, Klaus Schwab is threatening the head of government of the 20 most industrialized nations in the world to carry out the programmatic points of the Great Reset in their nation. This goes far beyond the pandemic. It is a global coup d'etat against which it is essential that people rise up and that the still healthy organ of state start an international juridical process. The threat is imminent and serious. Since the World Economic Forum is capable of carrying out its subversive project, and those who govern nations have all become either enslaved or blackmailed by this international mafia. In the light of these statements, and those of others no less delusional than Yuval Noah Harari, Schwab's advisor, we understand how the pandemic first served as a trial balloon for imposing controls, coercive measures, curtailing individual freedoms, and increasing unemployment and poverty. The new step will have to be carried out by means of economic and energy crises, which are instrumental to the establishment of a synarchic government in the hands of the global elite.
So that's Archbishop Vigano. A much longer speech he gives there, a talk about the World Economic Forum. He's just picking up on the Bali World Economic Forum they're speaking last month, Martin, about the World Economic Forum. But I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. He goes on to talk about a kind of demonic feudalism.
Well, obviously, the G20 was in Bali. The World Economic Forum were there trying to push their stuff. So, but of course, the G20 didn't necessarily go, all of them didn't necessarily go along with it. This is a project of the Western states, the core of the capitalist imperialist system. But the G20 includes also Russia. It includes Lavrov went. It also includes the Chinese, who noticeably didn't talk to Rishi Sunak. They cancelled a meeting with him at the last minute in order to snub it.
And what do you think of his attempt there to put it into a spiritual context?
Well, I mean, if people have got spiritual background, they're going to see this struggle in spiritual terms. I haven't got a problem with that. People have got all of the resources of human civilization are going to have to be used against this evil. Come on. And some people he's obviously a Catholic archbishop. But there's no reason why Protestants, Muslims, and people who don't believe in any God can cooperate together to defeat what they're trying to do.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what's got to happen.
Well, I think it's you know, as it's Christmas, we'll be repeating this show next week. We won't have a live show next week. But Brother Alexis Bugnolo, who we've had on this program once before, because he did a fascinating discussion with Dr. Zev Zelenko. And here he is.
A manifesto for the free peoples of the earth. When, in the course of human existence, it becomes necessary for humanity to break free from injustice and corruption, it has ever been recognized, lauded, and praised that humans yearning to be free have risen up and overthrown their evil overlords. This is innately recognized as right and necessary, because the honest and innocent man, by his very nature, has the right to not be oppressed and punished, exploited or swindled. This is even more true among the societies of men than in our personal relationships or contracts. For as Aristotle says, there is no society of men unless there is a coalition of the many to defend the honest against the wicked. And it cannot be simply to conduct business, or else it is not a state, but a mere social compact. Since the declaration of the pandemic in January of 2020, the free peoples of the earth have been subjected to an intentional plan of extermination, medical experimentation, psychological manipulation, social deprivation, starvation, and a coordinated plan of civil repression and enslavement, all focused on inducing each and every one of us, under the illicit use of governmental force and power, to take injections of substances called vaccines to permanently destroy or alter or our natural biologic functions at the cellular or genetic level. Millions have already been killed during this international scam. Hundreds of millions are going to die as a result of these injections. This is without doubt the greatest crime against humanity in the history of humanity itself. At Nuremberg, following the Second World War, the nations of the earth assembled to put on trial the men who were deemed most responsible for the unspeakable crimes against humanity committed during it. Many were hung, too many light sentences were handed out, and many were not even brought to trial. Since the outbreak of the scandemic in 2020, a grassroots, internationally diverse, spontaneous host of private investigators, experts, doctors, journalists, and private citizens began an investigation into this international conspiracy. And the conclusions of that investigation have been corroborated by hundreds of thousands of citizens doing research on the internet, in archives, in laboratories, and through the testimony of tens of thousands gathered and published on alternative media sites.
So that's Brother Alexis Bugnolo. That's Alexis, A-L-E-X-I-S-B-U-G-N-O-L-O, Bugnolo. Okay, so he's really just beginning his kind of introduction to his manifesto there, Martin. But, I mean, there is obviously quite a lot of religious people out there, Christians, these last two we've just heard from, who are getting sort of, well, they're saying basically people have got to come together to resist this. Now, this is going to happen in all sorts of fields, surely.
I'm just curious to know what version of Christian he is. He's obviously a brother, so he's a monk of some kind. Is he a monk in the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church?
I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, it's rather important, isn't it? But never mind, let's put it aside. I think this is a pandemic. I've said this before. But the virus itself is part of the killing process. It's warfare. And actually, warfare, there is a spiritual dimension, there's a moral dimension, but there's also a physical dimension of just killing people. And it's a fight. And I'm not a pacifist, Tony. I don't know if you are. Most people aren't when it comes down to it. Very few people who can actually honestly say that if their life was threatened or their threat to their family, that they wouldn't fight. But if just saying you're going to fight isn't enough, you've also got to fight to win, which means knowing exactly what you're doing. And that requires organisation.
No, well, I totally agree. So anyway, any last thoughts as we say goodbye to 2022?
Well, it's been a tumultuous year, hasn't it? And 2023 is going to be even more tumultuous. But it was always going to be the way. Because all of these trends in human civilization are coming to a head.
Well, Mike Harris is saying that he was saying earlier on he thinks that 23 and 24 is going to be really traumatic.
Well, it's pretty clear that it will be. But it's like any crisis, you know, it's like a mining disaster. If you panic and run around like headless chickens, you're definitely going to die. So we need to start getting ourselves. I mean, what's happening is, on geopolitical terms, is that the US-British Empire, the Israeli cat's paws and all the rest of it, are being seriously challenged for the first time since World War II. Mm. So in other words, this is World War III. There's going to be a settling of accounts. A different hierarchy is going to emerge at the end of it. Or we're just going to
I'm reminded of Wesley Clark and his statement about seven countries in 5 years. Of course, they didn't get that. One of them was Syria. The plans have all seemed to be falling apart. And one thing that seems pretty
obvious would have told them.
Pretty obvious that any empire that tries to take on other parts of the world and their own population at the same time is going to fall.
Well, empires fall through overreach. That's what happens. Because of what worked last time, they think they try it again, and they carry on doing it until they run up against a brick wall. They've run up against a brick wall in the Ukraine. That's the turning point. Syria was a turning point as well. But of course, people in Syria are having a miserable Christmas. The Christian community in Syria, of course, largely supports the Assad regime because they don't want to be ruled by Saudi nutcases. And because of the sanctions, people haven't got access to basic things. People in Afghanistan are going to starve in the new year. So we're being told about the closure of the universities in Afghanistan to women. The real problem for women in Afghanistan is not going to university. Most of them will never go. It's just their kids dying because the Americans and the British have cut off the money that the Afghan government, it's the Afghan government's money. You know, this is, and when Adam Tooze, who's a financial historian, pointed out that when the West confiscated Russia's foreign assets, and as I said earlier, there's a new bill going through Congress that all Russian assets owned by individuals can be confiscated in the US and given to the Ukrainians to pay for weaponry. You can see that the system whereby we pretend that there's a neutral financial system and people just put their money in the bank and they can take it out when they want, that's gone. And the two sides of World War III are shaping up. It's pretty clear who's on what side.
Well, in a way, the interview we had with the guy from BitChute says it all. You know, if you haven't got a press out there that's able to replace the NSA, Google, YouTube thing, then you're never going to find out what's going on. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. And also, of course, to our sound engineer, Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do please send me interviews, story tips, poems via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses if you want to email. And you can subscribe to my weekly email list and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable Christmas. We'll be back in the new year. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at talkradio.org.uk at 5 o'clock Friday after next. God bless, and don't let the Illuminati banksters get you down.
I played all my cards, and that's what you've done too. Nothing more to say, no more ace to play. The winner takes it all, the loser standing small beside the victory.
does it feel the same when she calls your name? Somewhere deep inside, you must know I miss you. But what can I say? Rules must be obeyed. You feel sad, and I understand. You've come to shake my hand. I apologize if it makes you feel bad, seeing me so tense. No self-confidence, but you see, the winner takes it.